Okay. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jean-Pierre Wolf, your chair. Welcome to our Friday, March 22nd Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. It is 8:15 a.m. So roll call, please.
Mike Johnson? Absent. Dr. Hunter?
Present.
Ms. Gray?
Present.
Dr. Wolf?
Present.
Mr. Young?
Present.
Ms. Harlan?
Here.
Mr. Delgado? Absent. Thank you.
All right. So next is introductions.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. Welcome back to Watsonville. It feels like we just left. I'd like to introduce a few people here. Up on the dais, on the far, my far left, is the clerk of the board, Tammy Olson. To my right is counsel Stephanie Yu. To her right is Matthew Keeling, assistant executive officer. And in the back of the room are a few of the section managers, Taya Tryon, Angela Schroeder, and Chris Rose. I would note that board member Johnston just showed up too.
All right, so next item is approval of board meeting minutes.
I will move to approve.
I second.
Any further comments? So roll call, please.
Dr. Wolf?
Approved.
Ms. Gray?
Aye.
Mr. Delgado? Ms. Harlan?
Aye.
Dr. Hunter?
Aye.
Mr. Johnson?
Aye.
Mr. Young? Thank you.
All right. So the next item is report updates from Regional Water Board members. So I will start on my left.
I had two meetings to report. I had a telephone meeting with Beth and Kevin from the Vineyard team last week, and I met in person with Jess Brown, Kirk Schmidt, and Abby Taylor Silva for lunch and a brief conversation.
All right, Mr. Young?
I had two meetings myself on March 14th. Kurt Schmidt and Abby Taylor Silva came to my office, and we met for an hour and 40 minutes, and we discussed basically everything they presented to us during their presentations. I don't think there was anything different than that. I spent most of my time talking to Kurt about his ideas, not so much with Abby. And then I also had a phone call. Beth was on the phone with Kevin Merrill. That was on March 15th. We just spent 20 minutes on the phone, and we just discussed the SIP program and their desire for having our staff agree to acknowledge or accept the Vineyard SIP in our ag program. And that was it.
All right, thank you. And then moving on my right, Mike.
Sure. So let's see. On February 14th, I met with Amy Newell, the board chair of the Pajaro Valley Regional Water Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency. To go over, we have started meeting regularly just to, and this was the first such meeting, to touch base on local and regional water issues. And in particular, we spent a lot of time discussing their problems with SGMA and how they might advance it. They had just done a basin management plan and spent quite a bit of money on it right before the right before SGMA passed and submitted it as an alternative, and are waiting to hear back from DWR. So. And then on the 21st of February, I went over to the Community Water Center's new office in Watsonville and sat down with both their local staff and Susana D'Anda and Jonathan, whose name escapes me, who's their legislative guy. Both they were about to meet with Senator Caballero and kind of wanted to pick my brain on that, and we spent quite a bit of time talking about how I might help them connect with the local community here. On February 22nd, I went down to Castroville, met up with Dale Huss from Sea Mist Farms, and he took me out and showed me some of the constructed wetlands work that they've been doing. And we also discussed 4.0, and he filed a disclosure on that. On about March 13th, I spoke with Matt Johnston. Full disclosure, he's my brother, who's the head of code compliance for Santa Cruz County, about the how this winter, once again, there's sediment all over the road in front of the county landfill outside of Watsonville. He explained to me that that wasn't them, that that was some, they believed it was some farmers farming on a slope, and that they had had real trouble figuring out how to regulate them and getting their attention. As soon as it became clear that it might be an enforcement matter, I worked to set up a meeting between County Public Works and our staff. I think it's a real good opportunity with the cities and the counties both. We regulate them, and we have you know, some of the built-in antagonisms of the regulator-regulated relationship. And so where there are situations where, with those public works department, which is kind of often the point of contact, where we can use enforcement powers that we have and they don't to help them deal with problems that they have, I for a long time have viewed that as a real opportunity for us that we should look for ways to move on. So I believe there's I believe folks are going to meet and talk about it later today, but as it's a potential enforcement matter, I have made it clear to everyone involved I don't want to know anything about it. March 18th, somewhere around March 4th, at my initiative, I had a phone conversation with Mark Silverstein, the head of the Elkhorn SLU Foundation, to talk to him about, and to pick his brain a little bit about the question of tidal gate operation. There's a multitude of tidal gates in Elkhorn SLU and a patchwork of agencies responsible for them. And I've heard quite a bit about problems caused by improper operation or maintenance. Improper might not be the right word, but by operation or maintenance of those in terms of the scouring and other stuff going on there. So I wanted to pick his brain about getting a better understanding of that problem and whether that might be something that that we can help on. I've talked a little bit to staff about it. I just don't think that they have the bandwidth to go out and look for new work to do at this point. But I thought I would just try and understand it better. So that was a useful conversation, and we're going to continue it. On March 18th, I spoke with Deborah Orr, I think is her last name, who is the attorney who's the lead on nitrates for the Community Water Center. She spoke to us yesterday. We kind of touched base on 4.0 and what we were going to be doing here, and her thoughts on it, and of course that was also the subject of a disclosure. I assume I advised her that And on the 19th, I met with Kirk Schmidt at the Farm Bureau in Watsonville for probably an hour and a half, and heard quite a bit of what he had to say, mostly dealing with nutrient management. That's all I've got.
Thank you. Dr. Hunter?
Yes, I just have one item to report. I had a phone conversation on March 19th for about 30 minutes with Abby Taylor Silva and of Grow Shipper, and we discussed primarily their alternative plan that they presented yesterday, and we touched on areas where she felt that there was consistency with the staff options. So we looked at areas where ag and staff see things pretty similarly. She mentioned there were some differences, but we really didn't have the time and agreed we would follow up in a after this hearing to continue a conversation about the areas where they feel they would like to see some different components look closer to what they feel they need. So I felt it was a good start, and I look forward to continuing. I know she said she would file the appropriate form.
Ms. Gray?
Good morning.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter.
Yes, thank you. So on Wednesday, February 20th, I attended an agricultural roundtable with Congressperson Salud Carbajal in Santa Maria. It was primarily made up of growers in the Santa Maria Valley and portions of the San Ynez and San Antonio watersheds, as well as Grower Shipper. Then on Tuesday, March 12th, I met with Tannis Thorlickson and Tim O'Brien from Driscoll's. We talked about 4.0 and issues primarily related to berries. And then on March 13th, I spoke with Kurt Schmidt and Abby Taylor Silva on 4.0 issues, both of them for about an hour. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gray. And then my report on 214 had a conference call, which included our executive officer with our state board liaison, Ms. D'Adamo, and that was to update our progress with 4.0. Then on the 3-4 monthly chair call, where all the chairs have a joint conference call with state board, and the topics we're planning the upcoming chairs meeting, which is going to be in April, and the chair of a state board has decided to remain as the liaison for the chairs, where in the past the tradition was the vice chair of state board would be the liaison with all the chairs. So this is a change, and I think the spirit here is to have more direct communication. And one of the topics that has been chosen is going to be relationship between regional boards and state board, and relationships between regions, but also regions with state board and state board with regions. And this particular topic was covered in 2017, but it was felt that it was important to have a check-in and see how things are going, because, you know, as you heard, there are several state-wide regulations that are being developed and subsequently need to be implemented with the regions. So in 2017, I spearheaded this, and I'm going to do the same. So one of my tasks is to do a little survey with the chairs to get their input on you know, these relationships, and we'll try to bring this in a very constructive, positive way at the meeting and having a frank dialogue on how you know, can we further improve the relationships? Since it is a different level, the executive officers have, you know, similar meetings, but this way it also comes from chairs who tend to look sometime at things from a different perspective. So I have my homework lined up for that. Then on the 13th, met with, the rest of you, with Abby Taylor Silva and Kurt Schmidt, without repeating, you know, what you shared, same type of discussion. I didn't keep track of time, but I think it was probably around a couple of hours that we met. And we met at my house. So then I had a phone conversation, which included Mr. Robertson with our CDFA, Ms. Karen Ross, to update on our progress with 4.0. Then we did the same thing with our new Cali PA Undersecretary, Mr. Blumenfeld, and gave updates also on where we are with 4.0. And then we did the same with the governor's office, Ms. Kristi Stoffaker, to provide updates. And our executive officer and myself feel that it is very important to keep, you know, I'll call it generically Sacramento, updated on our activities and progress. We will also subsequently have a follow-up in conjunction with the upcoming chairs meeting where Mr. Robertson and myself will spend most of the week in Sacramento and then face-to-face again meet and provide updates, which will reflect where we are with the last 2 days of meetings that we had. And that way, there is this very good relationship established because, you know, as you, I'm sure, well aware, you know, stakeholders themselves have regular communication with the folks I talked about. So we want to make sure that, you know, they get firsthand from us, you know, where our progresses are being made. And then lastly, I had, although this really doesn't quite tie to the regional board, I was a visiting lecturer at Cal Poly. You know, I do this, you know, no money's involved. I just enjoy some time, the contact with students, because the College of Ag, Food, and Environmental Science of Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, if you take the ag business track, you are required to take a class on environmental law, because we feel that future business farmers need to have a good understanding of all the different aspects of regulations that they will be exposed to. So my part is more a little the waterscape in the state and the type of regulations that as a future young farmer they're going to be exposed to. And I had a similar presentation done with Farm Credit West. And Farm Credit West, which is a banking organization that specialize in agriculture portfolios. They sponsor the Young Farmers of America program, and then similarly, this was a class presentation pertaining specifically to water, because as financial banking increasingly the Sigma, for example, as being a very critical component of risk management of agriculture portfolios. So that's becoming almost a mandate for them now as they work with young adults. So that's my updates. Thank you. And our next item is going to be we will not have a report from our state board liaison. She was not available to join us. Our next item is going to be a public forum for items which are not on the agenda. So do we have any speaker card? I haven't seen the card, so I cannot. Yeah, these are all yesterday. Yeah, and we have more speaker cards than people in the room, so that. All right, so then our next item is to circle back to a little bit of the unfinished business of yesterday. And, you know, first I want to reiterate my appreciation to staff and to all my fellow board members for your patience and your and making the efforts of being a good participant, even though as I was reminded several times, it was a long, long day. But I, it's not remaining unnoticed. It's very much appreciated. And certainly one of the lessons learned is to perhaps tamper down our optimism in terms of scheduling how much time it takes. We usually put a multiplier, but obviously we're going to have to tweak that multiplier because don't want to have 4.0 becoming your 9 o'clock at night meetings. I don't think it serves any good purpose. Both for us, it doesn't make it easy to make good, sound decisions, and I think it's also unfair for stakeholders who, legitimately cannot stick around late at night to go through, lengthy conversations. But it was important also yesterday to have as much as possible free flow of questions and answers so the process is fully transparent and we're not shunting anyone away from, having their input. So having said that, the item that I'd like to circle back before we move to the rest of the agenda is the continuation of the 4.0 items. So we need to look at, one, being able to address the follow-up on table 5. We need to continue then our discussion on where we want to get provide directions to staff, and we need to deal with the logistics of time availability. We do have some constraints in April that maybe you can give updates.
Sure. As we following the close of the meeting last night, as we started to look at critical individual schedules, we were not able to match up a date in April that worked for critical staff and stakeholders. And as such, we decided that it's better actually to target May, where everybody has a planned date secured on their schedule. Go on with that?
Okay. Yes.
So this item, the continuation of deliberation and discussion will take place at the May board meeting. What we want to discuss right now is adding a day to the May meeting so that there's sufficient capacity to get that done and not block out the May material that had already been planned to go. And I realize that that is a burden on some of your schedules. But if you could look at your schedules right now, secure. So the specific add-on date is May 8th, Wednesday, May 8th. The current board meeting is May 9th and 10th, Thursday and Friday, traditional. But we'll also add in Wednesday, May 8th.
So there was some question yesterday that the chair wanted more than a day for. So does just May 8th take care of that or not?
Well, we'll have to sit down and see what's on May and see what absolutely has to stay on May or what can move to a different date of the already existing agenda content.
Yeah, and you know, Mr. Young, you know, thank you for reminding that because, again, I just said we need to temper our optimism and I don't want to fall back into that path. I certainly would love a situation where, wow, we did well. We finished ahead of time. I don't think anyone would have grumbles over that. So, indeed, we're going to have to carve that out. These, you know, that proposal that we make to the rest of you, you know, is not something taken lightly. But when Mr. Robertson mentioned that some of our staff will not be available, there's some key staff, for example, even our council who is intimately familiar with the East San Joaquin order, you know, is not going to be available. And we need the support in addition to Ms. Yu of, you know, that Southern Council representative. There are also, without, you know, there are also some key stakeholders who indicated they would not be available. And I think this process still is going to require, you know, a lot of public presence. Because, for example, as we discussed Table 5, I mean, that does require also public input. You know, we haven't closed that item and no more public input. So there's the, you know, that bit of a challenge that we need to make sure we respect.
If I could just add, I think if you continue to remind us that this we're not going to be deliberating on a final order, a final action, but giving direction on the creation of a draft order, we might be able to hold back some of the nitpicking that we would normally do, and rightfully so, at the end, so that we can give staff the direction to start to flush out what a draft order will look like. We might be able to get through in a day.
Have a talk with Bruce. Just kidding.
I think that's a good point. I do want to caution, though, we do have CEQA that has to move forward, and so we want to ensure that the CEQA process is as embracing as it needs to be. So while I sympathize with the nitpicky item, I think it's really important to have those nits picked out or refined or those points nuanced so that we have the most accurate CEQA process that we possibly can.
That's fine.
But, yes, I think, you know, yesterday we allowed a lot of, you know, free flow. We were very generous with the speaker cards request. And for the record, Mayor Delgado is here at 20:29. Thank you. But this was done purposely because In this process, we definitely need to give the opportunity to, you know, to everyone to speak. But I do agree at the same time of the importance of, you know, it's a maybe strong word, but disciplining ourselves and, you know, asking our questions. And sometimes there are ways of asking the question in a succinct fashion. But I do agree with Ms. Gray that you know, CEQA, it's the devil is in the details, and having a CEQA done in a vacuum is yep. Yeah, thank you. So having said all that, I'd like to get everyone's input and Mike.
Certainly. My current plan is to miss the May meeting, as I had scheduled a 3-week trip down the Grand Canyon in late April and early May after verifying that we would not be handling anything to do with 4.0 at the May meeting. I really am going to have to give it some thought. I think I'm fairly conflicted about it because setting the direction for the first draft of this order. Maybe the most consequential meeting so far in the course of my two terms on this board. And I have no certainty that I'll be on the board next year when this comes up for a vote, if indeed it comes up next year. This is also the trip of a lifetime, too. So I have to figure that out. If I choose to cancel that trip, I would certainly be available on Wednesday because I don't have anything scheduled then. But my plan at this point is to not be here in May.
And basically, it's not an issue. You know, I didn't know where your trip would be. It's not a matter of can we move it a week left or right. It's basically right smack in the middle, if I understand.
Yeah, I believe my calendar has me. Well, I can tell you right now. I have to fly to Salt Lake City, and then we'd have to drive down and pack on the ramp and take the trip and then pack out and fly, drive back to Salt Lake City. So let's see. I have myself leaving on Thursday, April 18th, and returning on Sunday, May 12th. And we are not going to be landing at the end of it's a 21-day trip. We won't be landing until, Saturday of the morning is Saturday the 11th of May. So
I really
want. It is
wanna,
what it is.
Well, yeah, but, you know, you're a great contributor to these meetings, okay? I mean, you ask some great questions, just trying to see if there's a way of, you know, still have your contribution. I'm out of a box thinking here, you know, and all of you make the decision, not me. If I understand correctly, the following week would work for you. Is that a correct statement?
I'm just looking at my calendar again. All I have is a doctor's appointment in there, which could easily be moved.
You're in good health. So that's coming from Dr. Wolf. Mr. Robertson, could we do something like that?
So just to be clear, you're talking about pushing back by 1 week all those dates.
1 week.
Right. Okay, that's what I'm looking at right now. Okay, so from my schedule, that works. We'll have to check the availability of the room, but I think the room will work.
Yeah, we...
So we're looking at the specific days are Wednesday, May 15th, Thursday, May 16th, and Friday, May 17th.
So in terms of a room, we're the landlord, so I think we have connections.
We'll look at that right now. We're going to look at that right now.
Okay. So while you look at that right now, I don't want to have unintended consequence with my other colleagues here to say, well, now I have a problem. How would that work if we push this back 1 week?
I'm checking my calendar to see if I'm available to pick nits those 3 days.
Well, that's shrill.
I'm available either, you know, the week before that Wednesday or the following week.
Stephanie? I'm available.
Yeah.
I'm available, yeah.
Monica?
So the room is available, and ML is available.
Cool.
Okay.
Monica?
I do have a conflict on the 16th, potential to that I could miss that. It's a board foundation board meeting mm-hmm. that I'm a member of. But we're a small board, so getting a quorum is always difficult. Let me go ahead and say yes. If we were to do this, I know we can't say right now which day the ag order would be scheduled. It might occur that I would have to leave early one day
mm-hmm.
in order to hold the quorum for the board meeting, because those are set at the beginning of the year.
And that would be understandable.
Yeah, as our meetings are. So
maybe we could have a one-on-one discussion, and we can construct the schedule a little bit around that awareness.
I can tell you right now it's on the 16th, starting at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. It runs 3 to 5.
So you and John kind of tweaked that. Myself, I was out of town on business, but I'm totally willing to make that change because I really, really would like to have your contributions. Looking in the back, do we have thumbs up?
Yep. Okay. Yes.
So,
Dave, we're fine.
Jeff is fine. Yeah. Stephanie was fine. Everybody's fine. And Monica is willing to, you know, work around that. And then you'll be coming back totally refreshed with awesome pictures.
I am really humbled and honored by your consideration for me. I have to say, despite the fact that both Steve Shimek and Kay Mercer, who was watching yesterday, have advised me they think I should take the damn trip. I was probably going to end up having to cancel because this is really important work, as we all understand. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So I was just going to reiterate. So the new dates for the May board meeting, for the record, are Wednesday, May 15th through Friday, May 17th. We haven't yet figured out exactly where we'll put each of the items that we have. We also looked at, to Mr. Young's comments about you already have stuff on the May meeting, we took a look at that, and we think we can accommodate or move, reschedule, so that we'll have a significant block of time, day and a half to 2 days of that 3 days available.
All right.
I think it works.
Thank you, everyone, for your Bruce?
I'm good Wednesday, Thursday, and I have a conflict on Friday. So,
well, we make sure Wednesday and Thursday is 4.0 and Friday other items. So I want to thank each and every one of you for your flexibility. Thank you, staff, also, for accommodating us.
I just want to add that we do not plan to provide significant additional materials. I'm trying to manage the weight that falls onto staff in preparation of this meeting. We do not plan to provide significant additional materials for this meeting. We have teed you all up for this discussion, and this is kind of a continuation of the discussion.
Yeah. And we'll work on the details.
Right. I just want to be transparent here that we're not going to do a huge workup here in terms of big new staff report.
No,
but we'll
work on a little refresher. That way everybody's memories will be
as fresh as can be.
Yes.
And also, as I think we've discussed, and I don't think this is a load on staff, that perhaps there can be some collection of legal questions from board members so that council can then prepare some guidance. And I do have a procedural question. Since this is Well, it's a continuation of an agenda item, but it is at a separate meeting. Does this mean that people who have commented in the last 2 days have another opportunity to comment or not? It's just a procedural question I'm curious about.
I think that would be at the board's discretion, whether or not you wanted to. I don't think there's an obligation to have another. You're talking about oral comments at the meeting or written comments?
I'm talking about oral comments at the meeting, and I'm frankly, you know, while we will all be a little rusty on the one hand, on the other hand, I think we were pretty we bent over as far as we could over the last few days to give people ample opportunity to give us oral input, and we do need to finish this item. So,
we only agree with all that. The only item is we have not covered Table 5, and you know, so I don't think we should shut that part. So maybe, and we'll, you know, we'll work for details, but maybe, yeah, maybe what we can do is carve out comments for 5, but not, that, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Them, yeah.
And that way it does allow the public process to take place. Sounds good? All right.
And so that should be in our notice also that goes out, that we're going to carve that out. Might we be starting at 8 o'clock on Wednesday? I'd like to know because that affects whether I come up the night before or not. You guys have any feel for that?
I hadn't really thought about that far. I think we need to maximize the days as much as possible, and we'll make accommodations for you.
Okay.
I think the earlier we start, the better.
Okay.
And maybe the trade is we finish a little bit earlier Friday, right?
Yeah.
That's the carrot?
I don't like this.
All right. So thank you. Duly noted. So since we're on a roll, let's move to our next item, which is update on City of Salinas stormwater permit reassurance.
Actually, it's public forum.
Oh, no, we did. We did. And yeah, there was no...
No cards.
Well, Tammy tried to give me 14 cards, but I...
So just ask if there's anyone.
And just to make sure, although we did, I did that already, do we have anyone in the room who has not submitted a speaker card yet? Okay. All right. So let's move to introduction of the next item.
This is an information item. It provides the board with an update on the status of permit reissuance for the Salinas Municipal Stormwater Permit. The goals for this item are to provide an understanding and a foundation for the forthcoming permit item we anticipate coming before you in September. And then staff in the city will also cover how Salinas has grown implementation of their program over the years. From a fairly, as most of you recall, a fairly conflicted past in implementation to a much more engaged present. With that, I'll hand it over to Dominic.
Thanks, John. Good morning, Chair Wolf and members of the board. My name is Dominic Rock. I'm the Stormwater Program Manager for the Central Coast Water Board. This morning, we're presenting an informational item on the Salinas Stormwater Permit reissuance process. I'll be co-presenting with my staff, Tamara Anderson, who's the lead staff on preparing the permit. We're going to expand a bit on the staff report that's in your board package. And our intent is really to provide you a foundation for the item that we'll be bringing back to you in September, which would be a proposed reissuance of the permit. We'll talk about the schedule for the project that ends, hopefully, in September. We're going to go into some detail about the water quality challenges that the city of Salinas faces in solving the stormwater debacle, if you will. I also want to talk about how the permits and the programs that they regulate have matured over time since the 90s when these permits started. And then how those are being reflected in the new permit that we're going to be developing. And then we'll conclude with some opportunities that we see that the city could seize on to promote improvements to its program and compliance with the permit. We'll also hear from the city of Salinas after we're finished for about 15 minutes, and they'll go into a little more detail about the status of their implementation. This presentation is really not going to go into the weeds on the history of compliance of the program. We've actually come to you multiple times with interim reports on the status of the permit implementation and compliance. But we wanted, you know, for this item really to lay a foundation for where this permit is going to go next.
Could you remind me when the permit first started?
I will actually give you a full history of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Thank 1999 you. To answer the question. So given that this is really to provide more of a foundation for a future action, we want to impress upon you and leave you with some takeaways, including that the permit has grown in complexity. I think that will be apparent. And but that the city has actually made significant progress in implementing the permit and its program. There are, however, remaining water quality challenges that the city of Salinas and really all big metropolitan or cities face in managing stormwater, but that we're going to reassert that attainment of the water quality goals is, in fact, the goal of the permit. And we're going to also describe how the permit will provide options and flexibility for the city to achieve compliance. So some background on stormwater regulation. We regulate stormwater through the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permitting, NPDS. And what we're regulating is the discharge from a municipal separate storm sewer system. Salinas has one of those, as do most cities in this state, and it's distinguished from what are known as combined systems in other parts of the country, and in fact in Sacramento and San Francisco as well, where co-mingling of sanitary sewer and storm water is actually how their systems are built. But these are separate storm sewer systems, and we regulate them through a Phase 1 MS4 permit. Phase 1 refers to the sequencing of the regulations as they came out of the federal government. Phase 1 refers to the larger communities that were over 100,000, population over 100,000, and Salinas is, in fact, the only Phase 1 permit that we have in our region. All of the other communities and cities and counties are covered under a general permit known as the Phase 2 permit, and they are regulated separately. So in Salinas, we've issued this permit three times, or you have, the board has, 1999, 2005, and in 2012. So here's a image of the watersheds and the water bodies that the city of Salinas is discharging to. The city is in pink, and Highway 101 runs up through the middle of it. So compliance with the permit is based on these different meeting these receiving water limits in certain discharges. So we have a discharge at the Salinas River, as well as discharges to the water bodies in the city itself, and they're all leading to the Monterey Bay sanctuary. So compliance is based on whether the discharges from the storm drain system are affecting these receiving waters. All permits in California, that's me, sorry. All permits in California include a clause known as the receiving water limitations, and this clause states that discharges from the MS4 shall not cause or contribute to exceedances of the water quality standards in any receiving water. So the water quality standards we're referring to here include the Basin Plan water quality objectives for example, for aquatic life beneficial uses in all of those receiving waters. There's a slew of water quality objectives associated with temperature, dissolved oxygen, pH, et cetera. But we also have water quality objectives associated with the setup with the TMDLs that this board has adopted over the years, including the recently adopted Sediment Toxicity Team, DL, which provides the city until just a few years from now to come into compliance. The Fecal Coliform TMDL, which will be met, needs to be met by 2024. And the Nutrient TMDL, which provides a couple of dates, including one out at 2034. In addition to these basin plan amendments, the amendment to the ocean plan and the inland surface waters basin, enclosed bays and estuaries plan to include trash amendments has been adopted since our last issuance of this permit. And that requires that the city meet a set of expectations around trash reduction. The narrative water quality standard associated with that is that the trash shall not be present in inland surface waters and along shorelines or adjacent areas in amounts that adversely affect beneficial uses.
So let me ask you a quick question. And, you know, I had not had the benefit of, because of time commitments of getting the updates from you. So sorry if I have some questions that maybe I could have asked earlier. But big picture, my understanding, and I'm going to look at our attorney perhaps for the answer, on stormwater permits, there had been a couple of years ago some legal challenges. And these, to be very specific, these legal challenges were based on the principle of unfunded mandates. As we're looking at these, can you give me the quick 101 where that stands?
Well, it's actually currently evolving. It's continued to evolve because there are a number of test claims that are in court right now. But essentially, to back up a little bit on what unfunded mandates are, basically the way that the Supreme Court of California has interpreted it is that if there's a new program or higher level of service that is being required by the permit, more than what the federal NPDES requirement is, then that would be considered a state mandate, and if it's not funded, then it becomes an unfunded mandate that's not allowed by the California Constitution. So the way that we're working with this right now is to be even-handed with implementations of policies across the board, and trying not to put in new and higher levels of services. And I think that the best approach is probably to work collaboratively with the permittee.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Sorry, Dominic.
I'm actually going to turn it over now to Tamara, who's going to talk a little bit about the specific conditions that the city confronts in terms of managing its stormwater quality.
Thanks, Dominic. So the city is challenged with managing the typical pollutants that come off of an urban landscape. And the city has a population of over 160,000, so it's no small feat to manage the discharges that come off of the city's landscape and all the various land uses. As indicated by the zoning map, the city has the suite of urban land uses: roads, industrial, commercial, low and high density residential, parks. And we task the city with managing the numerous pollutant generating activities that are often associated with these land uses. And I'm going to review some of the common urban activities that without adequate source controls can be pollutant sources. So for example, residential, commercial, and municipal application of nutrients and pesticides being applied by both licensed and unlicensed applicators. Active construction sites are a potential source of sediment. Power washing of impervious surfaces outside of eateries on sidewalks can mobilize accumulated pollutants. Car brake pads and tires can be a potential source of metals. Asphalt sealants can contain hydrocarbons. And then often just from daily activities, trash can accumulate in streets. So to accelerate these challenges, the city, like most urban areas, is a sea of impervious area. And this image is of an area in Monterey County, and it shows the stark contrast between a natural landscape and a developed landscape. So many areas of, there's many areas of imperviousness in the in Salinas that are what's considered directly connected impervious area, meaning that stormwater is conveyed directly from the impervious surface to a storm drain or waterway, which creates a direct conduit for pollutants to get to the receiving water. And in this example, you can see that if it were to rain, water would hit the rooftop, go down the gutter, down the downspout, across this parking area, picking up accumulated pollutants, drop into that inlet, which is directly tied into the storm drain. And this method of managing stormwater in the built environment is so common, and it's a reason that why managing stormwater is just so challenging. So we also wanted to emphasize that the city is unique relative to many metropolitan areas in California, and that it's an urban area that's significantly shaped by agriculture. So as you can see, this is an aerial of the city of Salinas, and Highway 101 is running right through here, and it's surrounded by a sea of agriculture. And then there's also an area right in the middle of the city that is farmed. So the city is confronted with managing ag-related pollutants being brought into the city. So for example, this photo shows track out from a surrounding field entering the city's MS4 system. There's farm vehicles traveling from fields into the city on a daily basis.
And quick question, can you go back to, with a little island in the middle there?
Mm-hmm.
Is the city looking at some additional annexation right now? You know, through LAFCO, I'm sure there is a sphere of influence of potential area further.
So are you talking about within, so the area which is called Carr Lake in the middle of the city, which we'll discuss a little more later, is already part of the city.
Yeah,
but then what's called future growth areas, and Dominic's going to hit on that a little bit later about just how the city is expanding. And I'm not actually sure the status of the annexation, but yes, I know it's scaled for future development.
Okay, so you can talk a little bit more about that. Go mm-hmm. ahead, Jane.
So a significant portion of industry in town is also related to agricultural processing. For example, there's produce packing, cooling, and shipping facilities. And many of the residents in the city have these ag industry-related jobs and farming-related jobs. And this really shapes the community and the socioeconomic condition. And Dominic's going to discuss this a little more now.
Yes, socioeconomic factors definitely affect the city's progress in addressing stormwater. This is a map of mostly of the city. I don't have the city's boundary on here, but can you all see my cursor on your screen?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, the city boundary is basically this area here. And it represents the status of the census blocks that are designated as either disadvantaged communities or severely disadvantaged communities. And what you can see, if you would subtract this big block over here on the left and this one, everything else is in the city. And it represents the fact that about half the city is in a status of disadvantaged communities. So this really affects the city in a couple of different ways. The socioeconomic factors affect conditions on the ground that in turn affect urban runoff. So they start by having a smaller tax base, which means that their stormwater program is constantly competing for resources that are being asked for by other services they provide, like public safety and libraries and parks and rec and street repair. So there's a greater competition for resources at the fiscal level. But also, as far as conditions on the ground, because you have high-density residential areas associated with these populations, a relatively transient population for Salinas because of the seasonality of the agriculture industry and increasing amount of homelessness, there's actually challenges that the city faces for implementation. For example, accessing the streets to sweep them in an area that has many, many more cars than you would normally have in a neighborhood. So what we see is that all of these factors, whether it's the impervious surfaces are being washed down into the storm drain, the socioeconomic conditions, increasing homelessness, they all manifest in the city's storm drain system, which is where their point of compliance is for this permit. Let's look at the water quality data to see if we can see some expression of that. You see the pictures, but let's look at the data. This is a map, again, of the city. It includes the delineation of all the urban catchments within the city. So all these small polygons are individual urban catchments that drain to a specific area. But what I wanted to show you were the different monitoring points. And maybe Tamara can use the pointer on the screen for the audience here, but I'll show you on your screen. There's an outfall at the pump station. There's an outfall at the river. And there's outfalls along the rec ditch from these clusters of catchments. There's the one on, I think it's this mouse, there we go. There's this one here, and there's a couple up the upstream as well. There's also background receiving waters, so receiving water monitoring locations. So we have a couple of stations upstream and one downstream. Over time, there's been other receiving water locations upstream, and we also have receiving water locations on the Salinas River.
Dominic, what do you mean there's outfalls? Discharging what to what?
Yeah, so these are the outfalls. These are the physical structures that deliver urban runoff into a receiving water. In this case, it's going right into the rec ditch. So that's an outfall. Does that answer your question?
Stormwater outfalls.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So if we look at this graphic, which is a bit busy, and I'm only going to kind of make a point with it, but the point is to demonstrate that the percentage of samples that exceed action levels and water quality goals is generally fairly high. You don't see many zeros on this map or on this chart. But if we take, for example, fecal coliform over in the right, one of the right columns there, you can see that in the urban catchment pilot projects that were monitored for the two-year period of 2014 to 2016, exceedances occurred in all of those different catchments that I pointed out. And at all those outfalls. If we look at the Salinas pump station, which we have a longer record of data for, the pump station has a 59% exceedance rate for fecal coliform. The river outfall itself has a 41% exceedance rate. If we take a little closer look,
Can I ask? It's a pretty high number there, the fecal coliform. Do we know through DNA testing the origin?
That has not been done in Salinas at any level that we've gained visibility of it. There may be some academic studies, that kind of thing. But the city has not conducted DNA tracking or marking.
You probably know the cost has dropped drastically.
Yeah.
I mean, years ago, you know, it was $5,000 a sample. Now my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, we're down to the $250, $300.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different technology, too, and the whole microbial source tracking methodology has emerged as the method.
You know, and I'm not at all drawing conclusions here, but I think drawing from example with some other cities, you had mentioned homelessness as being an issue. We know contributing factor. I mean, there's only so many dogs and cats in the city, right?
So does it matter? I mean, if it's important, I think it'd be good to know. But if it's chickens versus dogs, cats versus raccoons versus people, what difference would it make if we knew?
Well, there's different outreach strategies, obviously, and different solutions to those problems. So if it's you know, if it's a matter of, you know, ensuring that pets are cleaned up after, or if there's a way that we can train people to, you know, ensure that their animals are not in areas, that's different than providing housing solutions, you know, on a temporary and permanent basis.
So then, in the current stormwater permit or this draft that's forming for the next, is there any link between confirming origin and changing outreach as appropriate?
The city has a fairly extensive strategy for addressing pathogen contamination. It's prioritizing human sources. So one of the first things they're doing is a heavy examination of their collection system and minimizing sanitary sewer overflows, for example, understanding those connections, identifying illegal connections. And that's exactly the direction we at the water boards have been trying to push, is let's make sure we focus on the human pathogen component, because pathogens are part of life, they're part of our environment, and they come from a lot of different sources. So we've emphasized human sources as the primary focus, and the city's working effectively to do look at their collection system, make sure it's not leaking. They've done a ton of smoke testing and that kind of thing. They can probably fill us in on a little more, but they also have broad outreach strategies for homeless. They've recognized the potential for homelessness to be a source of pathogens. Want to
All right, so then would this be a means to assess, or a metric to assess how well they're doing on those other efforts? For example, if the pump station river outfalls are primarily fecal origins of people, then it would indicate that there's some improvement there. If instead this was non-human animals, then it would indicate that perhaps they're doing a pretty good job on the human end.
So yeah, I think what we tend to do now with regard to the fecal the pathogen issue in municipalities is we really emphasize a set of implementation measures before we get to the point where we're trying to characterize it through microbial source tracking and DNA analysis. And the reason is that's so expensive, and you can't tease out much until you've narrowed it down. So what we do is we lead with source tracking, source identification, management measure implementation, and then when there's a remaining smaller set of sources that are unknown, we go in with those characterization methods. But you would never start with that. It would be, we already know what we're going to find. We're going to find human sources in these discharges at this time.
So you already can assume that most of the 59% exceedances in the pump station and the 41% the river outfall are due to human fecal coliform.
We cannot assume that. We know that there's a human component, but we don't know the magnitude of that.
So as a layperson, it seems like that's where the rubber hits the road, is at the end of the system, what's coming out, what's going into the receiving water, and what's the source of it, in order to backtrack to see, as a metric, how well we're doing at all the preventative measures. So I guess my last question will be, in the current order, in the current permit, or in the future draft permit, are we doing anything with these final numbers to determine where their origin is?
Yes, is the answer. The city is actually, under the current permit, required to develop a waste load allocation attainment plan for achieving the pathogen TMDL. And that plan lays out the specific measures they're taking, including the characterization of the discharges. I was just for saying that with regard to source tracking and DNA analysis, that's way down the list. You don't go there until you've narrowed it down considerably. And there's a lot of lower hanging fruit, you could say, where they can achieve a lot of bang for their buck and success before we introduce the microbial source tracking methods. And we see them making progress in that regard. So the current permit requires that strategy to be adopted, and the subsequent permit will continue that requirement.
Okay, thank you.
So, Dominic, this is data from 2014 to 2016.
Yes.
do we have data that precedes 2014 so we can see what the comparison is
yeah.
to see how well the city has been doing?
So this is the city's data from their monitoring program. There's a whole lot of other receiving water data through CCAMP, through Cooperative Monitoring Program, and we've looked at that data as well, but there's no really well-defined trends that we can relate to the city's discharges. And so it's one of the reasons why we modified the monitoring and reporting program mid-permit and tried to refine the precision, you know, improve the precision of the outfall monitoring program so that we can start to say what we're seeing coming out of these areas is actually, you know, urban contribution. We're not going to look in the receiving water as much because that's commingled with all these other sources. And we have a lot of data that just shows persistently high levels, in particular fecal coliform contamination. So we could provide like a much larger data set and provide a more comprehensive analysis of the existing data, but it wouldn't tell us anything that we don't already know, which is that there's a lot of coliform. There's no particular trend related to long-term trends, up and down, relatively speaking. The dry versus wet weather trends are more typical. You're going to see wet weather fecal coliform at a fairly consistent rate. So I wanted to present to you the data from their own program, but we have other data. And I'll just tell you, it doesn't support a very informed it doesn't support us to direct the permit in any particular direction, aside from let's find out what's actually coming off of their landscape rather than looking in the receiving water. We have a long record of receiving water monitoring.
So what you said, though, was that they're moving down some kind of prioritization tree right before they get to a more precision-based type of analysis to look at what's in the water. But I'd like to know, well, what are they doing? And I think it's being helpful, but the water quality data is not showing any improvement. So there seems to be a disconnect there.
That's kind of what this presentation is about. And if I continue, you'll understand that's a dilemma that we're facing with these permits. And there's no simple solution right now, but we have a direction we'd like to head.
So yeah, I appreciate that point, and I don't think there's a simple solution at all, but I do think that it highlights the need and the importance of having more collaborative solutions at the table. I mean, certainly we have in this area a high SDAC and DAC population, so there's probably some messaging and communication and further outreach that needs to happen. But if you are looking at people who are potentially living on margins and then the fact that the state of California has 25% of the nation's homeless population, and we've already seen that the majority of those people who are unsheltered are living in watersheds or living in water corridors, we can certainly, anecdotally make a clear line between fecal coliform and water quality. And in other portions of the state, the trash amendment is being implemented in a way that that takes out some of those floodplain management issues when there's huge debris in the way of people's living quarters and water courses. There's a portion of that that runs through this. So I think that this really highlights the need to raise the dialogue here, and how do we bring daylight to these issues and other solutions that are not just related to the stormwater permit. Obviously, we need to have funding, and I think we've discussed a little bit previously about the governor's approach to marginalized populations and vulnerable communities and the $1.3 billion for housing solutions. And so I think we can't look at the stormwater program in isolation of that, obviously. I mean, we certainly have to meet permit requirements, and it's not the responsibility of this permit to provide housing solutions. But I think as we find solutions, other people need to be at the table. And so raising the dialogue a little bit on the contributions to to stormwater. Pathogen contamination is high. That's very troubling.
Yep. Again, these are the outfalls as distinguished from the receiving waters.
And so. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree. These numbers are very high. The city of Santa Cruz had a homeless encampment on behind the county government center along the San Lorenzo River, and they put in bathrooms and hand washing stations. And then they moved that population to another location. Then they closed that location, and so the people didn't have anywhere to go. So then they went on the other side of the river and formed another encampment. So the city then, again, took them a little while, put in bathrooms there and hand washing stations. So maybe we can encourage the city of Salinas to do some of that also. But, these numbers are very, very high.
Yeah, I mean, we can ask the city to speak to the status of their implementation of their waste load allocation attainment program. It's multifaceted. It addresses some of the things that Board Member Gray was mentioning about reaching out to the disadvantaged communities, targeting the effort. I agree. It has a very multifaceted complexity to the problem. But there's also the reality that at some point, pathogens in the environment are going to be there. And what we're really most interested in is reducing the human component of that pathogen group. And so to get to the original question, I think at some point we will get to that stage where it's like we've got it at a point where we really need to know if we're dealing with a human component here remaining or whether, you know, we can assume that it's some natural sources. But these are evolving. The strategy for water boards to manage pathogen TMDLs throughout the state is quite active. And some of the larger municipalities have really started to move toward a more focused approach that once they've nailed down all their different sources, they go in and they do characterizations of using DNA markers and microbial source tracking. We think the city will eventually go there. I think it's a little premature for them to go there now because, as we pointed out, there's a lot of other things they can do and to nail down a number of lower-hanging fruit kind of actions. But I think maybe, again, the city will be able to answer some of these specific questions about their current strategy.
And I think right now Dr. Hunter had a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Dominic, just so I'm clear, the pump station is located where, and what is the operation there that is discharging?
So we'll go into a little more detail when Tamara describes a current project the city is pursuing. But the pump station is located down here. Where are we? I don't know. Nope. I don't know where we are. Let's see. Light was on.
Oh, it's 25. Looks like it's 25. Oh.
While we're pulling that up, so just briefly, about 30% of the city is all routed to that pump station. And then that pump station directs water through a pipe under an ag field that then discharges to the Salinas River.
So both the pump station and the river outfall, there are two different points at which this discharge is going directly to the river.
To the Salinas River.
Yeah. Right. And there's no, this data is just grab samples, or how does this data get grab samples?
Yeah, there was a time-weighted average approach using an ISCO sampler at the pump station for a while, but it was not functioning well, so they've reverted to a grab sampling strategy. So these are coming out of the outfall there, and then the other in the chart that I showed you, there's data from this. There's another outfall up here from a cluster of urban catchments. There's this one, and then there's two others, and those appear in the chart there under this those urban catchment.
Those are up above.
Yeah.
But the river outfall is where? Is that at the lower end of the river as it flows through the city or adjacent to the city?
I missed the first the part.
I said
first
the river outfall is where? Within the residential.
So the river outfall is right here, down here. You see my cursor?
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it's pumped from the pump station in a pipe.
Oh, I see.
Underneath agricultural fields.
Okay.
There's actually, you know, likely some infiltration from the groundwater in this area as well.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's actually, under this permit, we required the city to conduct a more detailed analysis of the data from the pumps, from the outfall. So they had consultants come in and do studies to compare the outfall to the pump station.
So,
but this is, again, and early on I presented a map that showed a big watershed divide here and pointed out that the city is actually all draining over here, but they have to pump it over into the river.
Yeah.
For, you know, flood control and other reasons, but it's, yeah, that's the current.
The pump station is generating a discharge through a pipe and comes out some miles away, and there's a difference of between the 59% and 41%. And you're saying, so what's happening? How could it?
Well, as I said, the pipe is not sealed, so we're expecting there to be infiltration of groundwater within the agricultural area. So, but again, you'd need a lot more data to nail down the precise relationship between the samples at those two locations. Preliminarily, it's apparent that there's inputs, for example, of nitrogen. So if we look at the nitrate table, the pump station didn't have any nitrate.
Right.
It has 60% exceedances at the outfall. But if you look over at orthophosphate, what's happening here? The pump station had 80%, but only 30% of the outfall. Like, are we potentially losing phosphorus? You know, it's not enough data to know. But there's definitely a likelihood that there's infiltration from the surrounding agricultural land. It raises concerns that the city has. It's like, why are we being held accountable for that? But the fact is it's their conveyance, and the permit requires them to be held accountable for that, or it holds them accountable for what comes out at the outfall.
Yeah, I think that's been contentious.
But there's some good things around the corner potentially for this whole drainage area where that goes to the outfall. So we're going to talk about that.
The other thing I note is that in the other sampling areas, there's no copper or zinc, copper being associated with urban road runoff, but it shows up at the pump station.
Yeah, that is interesting. Again, these are in the middle of the city, these catchments.
Right.
And so something could be happening within those catchments that's quite different from the portion that's draining to the pump station and the outfall, because they're different drainage areas. That's what's so critical about developing a spatially explicit understanding of your source areas, and that's been required under this permit, and it's laid the foundation for vast improvement in their strategy.
So what was the impetus for developing the pilot project? I'm sorry if you've already told us that.
It was in the last permit, so we discussed it, 12 years ago?
I guess it's been
6 years ago. Yeah. So I don't understand why you don't remember that. It was very much about developing a better understanding of the sources and characterizing what's actually coming off of the urban landscape as distinguished from what might be entering the city from the surrounding agricultural land or what might be generated by the agricultural land within the city. Again, we had a lot of data on receiving water conditions, and the city was unable, with repeated sampling, to distinguish its contribution. So we said, well, let's take a look at this, and we constructed a very pointed and directed strategy of urban catchment pilot project sampling. The sampling regime associated with those was hit or miss. There was a lot of dry weather, or, you know, not enough flow often to take samples. But it started that spatially explicit approach. And what we did mid-permit term was to modify the permit to refine that and get an even better, more refined and precise approach to the same idea, which is let's look at what's coming off of these landscapes. So actually the next slide talks about where we're going.
Okay. And thank you.
Okay.
And let me, Dominic, sorry.
Yes.
First will be Bruce, sorry, and then next will be Stephanie.
Sorry to make you go back one.
No problem.
To that table. I think if we were to assume that these were statistically significant, robust sample sizes, they may not be, but just let's pretend for a moment that this is based on a lot of sampling. The good news is that it appears that between the pump station and their outfall, agricultural infiltration has reduced the concentration of fecal coliform, which makes intuitive sense that you have a lot more people and municipal uses inside the city than you do outside the city where the agricultural fields are. So it seems intuitive and consistent that you would reduce coliform exceedances between the pump station and the river outfall after the influence of ag. And it also seems glaringly clear that you would go from 0% nitrate, which is, I guess that's not so obvious. You think there'd be some nitrates coming out of the city. But anyway, the data shows 0% nitrates coming out of the city, exceedances, and then you have agricultural infiltration, and it blossoms to 60% exceedances. So right there, it seems to be a good opportunity to see what's happening with the ag influence, good news and bad news, and what we do with it. We have options what to do with it, but if we were thinking about the last 2 days, what we would do with that information is we would look at the surrounding agricultural and say, why are we getting infiltration of so much exceedance from a relatively pure source to begin with if these were robust, if these were reliable samples? So I think there's a lot here, and I applaud the efforts to get to this point. It sounds like with more sampling, these data will become more useful, but they're already, you know, serving the function of telling us where we need to go, perhaps. And I'm appreciative of seeing these data. And I do want to note that the Salinas pump station goes back to 2006, so that's probably your single best row of data here to tell you what's going on. And just wanted to make those points. Thanks.
Stephanie?
The pump station is the sewage treatment facility?
It was at one time. There was a wastewater facility there years ago, but it's currently a pump station to move stormwater out of the city and down into the river.
Where's the sewage treatment facility?
Salinas discharges sewage to the regional facility in Monterey, regional facility operated by Monterey One Water.
This would, well, and continuing with Bruce's thought, this would be an opportunity to inspect that line and repair it if indeed it has so many leaks and cracks in it that it's drawing in the nitrates.
Yeah.
And we've had that problem in Santa Cruz County. We pay the sanitation district pays City of Santa Cruz to treat it and discharge it out in the ocean. And in wet weather, we were having a huge increase in the water that was sent to Santa Cruz. And as soon as we fixed one of our big lines, that went way down. So our costs went way down. So that line should be inspected probably immediately and repaired so that we don't have those nitrate levels in there, because that shouldn't be.
Can you give us the watershed that's going into the pump station?
Sorry, Bruce.
Yeah, that's coming up, Bruce.
I'd like to give the opportunity to Mike, and then after you can continue.
I mean, before we start kicking in all sorts of solutions, I'd like to hear the rest of the presentation. I mean, I don't want to quash anybody, but I have a feeling that they're going to come around to some of this stuff as we go through.
Bruce? Thank you.
Okay. I believe I was here. Yes. So this was sort of the general description of water quality outcomes, you know, focusing on urban sources. I didn't show you, I'm not showing you the receiving water data. But I thought I'd take a little deeper dive into it and show you how some of the newer monitoring strategies they're using is helping to improve the definition on this. So this is a group of catchments in the city, the red outline on the left, the red blocks there, and it's located up here. And what it is, it's a area known as Acosta Plaza. It includes single-family and multifamily residential and commercial and institutional land uses. So they're all urban land uses. We're not commingling with the ag at all. In fact, the image on the right shows you kind of the visual on the satellite imagery shows you that it's mostly a housing area of housing. But it also shows you, the image on the right, that this entire catchment is either disadvantaged or severely disadvantaged, the entire catchment. So when we look at the outfall coming off of this area, which is that yellow circle there, the city has done more refined data collection using a time-weighted approach, passive sampling approach. And again, we're still seeing fecal coliform, orthophosphate, and there's where the zinc and the copper are coming in. So we have clearly sources within these drainage areas. And it kind of gets to the point, which is that this map showing little blue dots, those are all of the storm drain inlets in the city. And what they're doing is they're connecting all the imperviousness that Tamara described to the receiving water. What we have here is a very efficient system for conveying pollutants from all of these activities, all of these land uses, whether it's homeless people or whether it's, you know, an industrial facility or the power washer who gets out there at night and takes down the oil and grease off of their sidewalks at their, you know, auto body shop. It's all going into the storm drain. And so the city's strategy has been, and the permitting approach has been, to implement all these different management measures that are going to get at those sources. It's not been treated at all. It's about preventing it from entering the storm drain. And so the stormwater permits recognized at the very outset that this was a very large, challenging problem. And in the 1990s, while the California permits all included receiving water limitations, you shall not cause or contribute to receiving water exceedances or exceedances of water quality standards in receiving waters, they recognized that just going after the numeric criteria was going to be a non-starter, and we're starting out, right? So they started, and you're quite familiar with this drill, with management measure implementation. And those management measures included, you've seen them all in previous permits, in the previous stormwater permits, in the phase two permits, public education and outreach, construction management, commercial and industrial source control, illicit discharge detection and control, and then getting your own house in order with municipal operations. And all of these management measures were intended to be pursued to the maximum extent practicable. And permit compliance would be achieved if we felt this was adequate. And so the city's first permit totally enshrined this approach. And we call it the iterative process, where you start something, you develop a plan, you implement it, you look at whether it's working. If it's not working, you change something, you keep trying. The iterative approach, they call it. The city's 2005 permit also preserved this basic strategy of the iterative approach. But like other permits throughout the state and throughout the country, it was clear there was an opportunity to affect future growth of cities, to sort of prevent the effects that we have in the current existing built environment from occurring in those new areas. So I think it was Dr. Wolf who had asked about future growth areas. And this is an example, this is a map of the future growth areas for the city of Salinas. And when we adopted the 2005 permit, there was considerable discussion about extending protections to those areas and essentially not making that same, you know, not perpetuating the problem of our urban form delivering so many pollutants to the water bodies. So what we did was we introduced something called post-construction requirements, or PCRs. You'll hear that term. And those refer to how a completed project that's built is going to respond to a rain event. And we required that the new development and redevelopment as well implement something called low-impact development, which minimizes the pollutants that are generated, mimics natural processes, disconnects imperviousness. Examples of that include bioretention systems, where, as you can see, the runoff from the parking lot is disconnected from any storm drain, and it's going directly into a vegetated area to help knock down the pollution loading, knock down the volume as well. Permeable pavers serve the same purpose. Now, the primary benefit to the city and to water quality was in the future growth areas, because they would build their new city, in effect, the new portions of the city, the right way, and we would disconnect the imperviousness, and we wouldn't confront the same issues in those areas. But we also required that redevelopment within the existing footprint of the city include these requirements. And the idea there is that we can kind of undo the damage that we've done with our existing infrastructure. But if you think about it, the rate and the pace of redevelopment is never going to be enough to completely reconstruct the city of Salinas historically, you know, historic footprint of the city. And so it really kind of we confront a fundamental issue with that infrastructure. The 2012 permit continued with some of the same principles of the iterative process. Let's keep trying with those management measures. Let's try to address the fecal coliform, the pathogen problem, with the same measures of, you know, going after the public education and outreach component, doing the illicit discharge inspections, doing the commercial inspections, doing sanitary system, you know, inspections and smoke testing. Do all those things. They're management measures and they're supposed to work, right? So we know that that's a very tall order. And so what we recognized was there's a potential to organize the information and to connect it to numeric outcomes, numerical quantifiable measures. So we required that pollutant load modeling be conducted, and the city has been doing that since the 2012 permit. We required that they prioritize their activity based on urban catchment or the loading from the different urban catchments. We also required that they begin tracking the structural control measures that are in place to actually knock down the load and reduce volume of discharge. And then finally, we asked that they prepare a spatially based information management system that allows them to use this new approach more effectively.
Can Dominic, yes. Sorry to interrupt. Can you define structural controls?
Sure. That would be any piece of infrastructure that receives stormwater and either reduces the magnitude by infiltrating some of it, reduces the loading by dropping it out in a detention kind of approach, or in some way treats or manages stormwater. So it could be detention basins, even catch basins, and any constructed piece of their infrastructure.
Can you, in seeing the way in which the city is approaching the 2012 permit and these requirements, can you tell us percentage-wise how much more of that is actually on the ground?
More structural control?
Yeah, yeah.
So the primary mechanism for increasing the amount of structural control has been through the redevelopment process. When a project comes up, we require them to put in some sort of structural control to knock down below the pre-existing loading. So there's a lot of parcels that have developed, you know, but again, it's a drop in the bucket relative to the whole acreage of the city. And then there's also larger scale infrastructure improvements that the city has been undertaking and pursuing. So they've got funding through a project that Tamara will discuss where there's a larger structural approach considered.
So, and does this apply to infill if the city is doing redevelopment?
Yeah, when I say redevelopment, that's what I mean.
It's
yeah.
infill.
So, yeah, anything in the city that within the city boundary, you know, its definition is kind of vague, but infill versus redevelopment, we kind of use the term interchangeably, but anytime there's something that an existing parcel in the city that needs to be redeveloped, usually there was some use already in place, so it's a redevelopment project, and it triggers the requirements to place structural control measures or an equivalent.
Are there any structural control measures associated with road maintenance?
And yeah, there is, and it's one of the harder things for the city to accomplish. Because those are projects that the cities are actually paying for through capital improvement budgets. So when they go in to put in a roundabout, for example, it triggers those post-construction requirements, and it triggers them at different levels. As you might recall, some of you, there's different tiers and thresholds for the amount of impervious surface that's either being replaced or constructed. And so depending on the scale of the project, a different level of stormwater mitigation is required. But those are some of the more difficult projects for the city to achieve the compliance with.
Sure, but it is now part of their design for any road work, any redevelopment, any areas. So maybe the city can comment on that. Yeah.
There's one more comment on the structural controls. Is the city also has on public and private lands a slew of what or historically might have been considered or put in for flood control purposes. So, you know, when a new development or old development went in, they put in big, for example, detention basins that might have just put in for the purposes of flood control, not water quality treatment. But the city has gone through an effort of evaluating where all of those are on the landscape and looking for opportunities for how could we potentially retrofit these to provide some water quality.
I was just going to ask, is there a possibility for retrofit to redesign to meet both flood control and water treatment, if you will?
Yeah. And it gets more challenging when it's a facility on private lands versus publicly owned and managed. But, yes, they are looking into that.
Interesting. I hope we see some examples of that from the city, maybe.
So, next will be Bruce and then Jeff.
Thank you. My memory of the 2012 permit was that it had a significant piece on enforcement improvement, but maybe I'm wrong. And when you talk about the 2012 permit on the screen, I don't see the enforcement, so that's why it triggered that question.
You recall correctly. One of the objectives of the 2012 permit was to improve on implementation and compliance because there were demonstrated problems with that. And our approach to doing that was to include more prescriptive and more detailed program requirements. So the current permit is very prescriptive. It tells the city, it obviously doesn't dictate the manner of compliance, but it gives them sort of the approach we expect them to take. And then it actually, you know, gives them alternatives. You can choose something comparable. But an example of that would be you need to use a structural control measure assessment strategy, a BMP assessment strategy. And you can pick among the options, but you need to start actually looking at how your BMPs are functioning because we want to know whether those facilities are reducing pollutant loading. We're going to get nowhere until we get some information about that. And that becomes the foundation for where to invest and where to improve and protect, potentially retrofit. But to your point, there were compliance issues, and it created quite a bit of controversy and tension.
Pre or post 2012?
Pre-2012. And as a response, Water Board staff created a more detailed and prescriptive permit to really create a little more clarity about our expectations. And it has been effective. And I was about to go into exactly some of those improvements, but I also wanted to point out that, you know, our approach today wasn't to get into the gory details of compliance and implementation. but more to kind of provide this larger foundation for the next permit. And I think there'll be plenty of opportunity to pursue that today, afterwards, after the presentation, but also in the intervening period as we develop the new permit and in the next hearing.
Thank you.
So if you have specific questions about compliance histories, we will definitely want to hear those and provide you answers.
Well, I'd want to know eventually how it's doing, maybe not today. Right. And I was just piqued because I didn't see it on the screen. And
yeah, we actually, I think, you know, the prior board presentation on the Salinas permit was really more about that. It was about here's how they're doing. We've had two since the permit was adopted. We've come to you twice and explained how they're doing. And we can kind of tee up those staff reports again and kind of provide a review of that in the next permit or in the next hearing.
So I guess my question is a little bit in follow-up to that. In a general sense, have any of the management requirements or controls provided positive feedback such that, hey, this works, this doesn't work? Or, you know, we're getting our bang for the buck if we start doing this more than something else. I mean, there's been this history of the management measures not leading, I believe, to any true water quality improvement. Is that because they weren't implemented properly?
Again, I think I'm going to try to provide a kind of a summary there, but I will say categorically that throughout the country, there's been a recognition by water quality regulators that the implementation of the iterative approach of just trying things over and over and sort of putting numeric water quality compliance objectives over here for the time being because this is a really big project, really big problem, that is not resulting in the anticipated outcomes, that overall we don't see improvements in water quality. So that's a background knowledge that we come into this permit with. And then we look at Salinas' specific experience with that. And absolutely we see benefits and improvements relating to implementation of management measures. I was just about to talk about a couple of them. But there's no doubt that the iterative approach works sometimes. Implementing these measures actually is effective. But overall, and even in the city of Salinas, we can conclude that it's not enough. We need to start moving toward an approach that quantifies the loading, targets the reductions, and provides specific milestones and timeframes to do that are more realistic. And so that is actually the direction we're heading, but go ahead.
So when you say there has been some improvement with the city of Salinas and its permit, does that improvement mean improvement to water quality or just improvement to the way they're implementing the measures?
We believe it's improvements to water quality that haven't been the signal of that hasn't been.
Okay.
We haven't been able to see the signal because
okay.
There's so many confounding factors.
Okay.
Very
right.
Hard to tease out the individual effect on water quality of a particular management measure. So the concept of effectiveness assessment is the term you're looking at, is really the term that describes what you're asking about. And effectiveness assessment in an iterative approach context involves looking at whether you did the action. That's the first thing. Did you conduct the number of inspections of commercial and industrial facilities that you said you would? Yes, we did that. Did you do anything about it when you found out there was a problem? Yes, we did that. Did you enforce on the individuals responsible? Yes, we did that. Or no, we didn't. So trying to get positive, affirmative answers to all of those questions has been challenging over the years. We're at a point where we know that we've been successful. For example, at night they go out and do inspections or kind of roving inspections to look for people who are power washing at night so they won't get caught by the city, which works primarily in the day. And sure enough, they have examples of people doing that. They ticket them. They enforce on them. That's a big improvement over the previous situation where they weren't conducting those types of, you know, that level of implementation. But do we see that in the water quality data? No. We're not seeing a signal for that. We know that's effective, but we know that's not going to show up anytime soon in the data.
Let me bounce this off you. I noticed that there's a number of these catchment basins that have been set up throughout the city. Would it make sense in the next permit to tell the city, you know, you can apply fewer resources to some of these basins and up the amount of resources you put into other basins so that we can kind of get an idea of can we really, you know, achieve true water quality improvement when you consider that, you know, resources to begin with are a limiting factor here.
Yeah.
We don't have all the money in the world.
Yeah.
So can we scavenge maybe, since we don't even know what's really working,
yeah,
and say, let's take all these resources and go after two basins and, you know, put the pedal to the metal and see, can we see an improvement without the limitation of resource?
Yeah, you're describing the exact model that we want to move toward, where there's actually some trade-off and we're not, you know, hugely increasing the level of service that they're implementing, but we're providing some trade-off and more flexibility in how the city pursues it, because up to now it's just been do everything everywhere all the time,
and
then we expect to see some results in the water quality. It's like, well, it's not working. It's not in and of itself enough. So I think we're going to hit on a lot of those different issues you raised.
Yeah, and I was going to suggest, you know, I took a sneak preview of your next slides, and a lot of these questions are actually going to be brought up. So maybe I would suggest we hold off a little bit more and let you continue your presentation, and I think you're going to help provide some of the answers. And then also let's not forget that, you know, the city will have an opportunity to even further expand on their ideas, and you'll have a chance to ask those questions. So maybe we can let Dominic finish his presentation.
So I had this slide up, which was just explaining that the 2012 permit, and it's funny, Bruce, because the issue about whether compliance was an issue and enforcement, I mean, that really, in my initial presentation, I was going to say, and the 2012 permit went after that, you know. But I really want to talk about where it's going, and so I wanted to emphasize that the 2012 permit included these particular features, these requirements to do this kind of quantifiable approach to prioritizing where you do your work. And they're really the foundation for where we're going to go next. But we still have this kind of fundamental challenge in permitting stormwater municipalities, in that we have progress that they're making on implementing the measures. We know that. We've seen evidence of them following through and implementing more effectively. But we have persistent water quality problems. So in terms of the things that they've demonstrated success doing, one of them was to bring on a full-time stormwater program manager, and that's Heidi Niggemeier, who's sitting over there, and she'll be getting up to give some comments from the city. And it's made an incredible difference in our interaction and our ability to work cooperatively and constructively with the city. They've also stepped up the industrial and construction inspections, and they followed through with enforcement on those. They have measurable reductions in trash and a fairly sophisticated strategy for trash source assessment and characterization and then trash reduction. They're continuing to make improvements to their street sweeping program. They've inventoried and assessed the condition of all of their city-owned structural BMPs and a good portion of the privately owned BMPs. And they've integrated that all into an information, really a state-of-the-art information system that was recently described in Stormwater Magazine by the city's consultant as a spatial analytics, you know, they said spatial analytics brings efficiency to the Salinas Stormwater Program, and that's a very apt title for what they've accomplished. But again, the data illustrate that the water quality challenge remains, and that the iterative approach in and of itself is not achieving compliance. So it calls for an alternative approach. What is that approach? Well, Water boards throughout the state have been working for the past several years to identify alternative compliance pathways. The term refers to alternative compliance with receiving water limitations. And a lot of this work has emerged out of the LA area, where the TMDLs basically started to direct stormwater program outcomes. And what the features of these alternative compliance strategies include are well-defined, transparent, and finite paths to compliance that provide the MS4s, or the permittees, with flexibility, longer timescales. They require management at a watershed scale. They include green infrastructure approaches as opposed to gray infrastructure. They include stormwater capture and use strategies, recognizing stormwater as a resource, not a waste. And they emphasize multi-benefit projects. So they get us beyond just exclusive focus on water quality at all, you know, for the only objective, and look for projects that might benefit the socioeconomic conditions of a community, might meet flood control, water supply, climate change resilience benefits. And finally, they require that the cities provide a reasonable assurance analysis, which is a robust analytical demonstration that the strategies will work given time. Providing these alternative compliance pathways is definitely a newer approach to permitting in the state, but they're now found in permits for MS4 permits for regions 2, 4, 5, and 9, and they're in the draft permits for Region 8. And the Central Coast Water Board staff intends
can
to
you,
pursue.
Can you, for the benefit of everybody else, name, because, you know, we
absolutely
know the acronyms. But.
Yeah, sure. The San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board, the Los Angeles Regional Board, the Sacramento Regional Board, the Palm, not the Palm Desert, the San Diego Regional Board, and the draft permits for Orange County.
Thank you.
Certainly. So we at the Central Coast Water Board intend to assume this responsibility and move our permits toward an embrace of this concept of alternative compliance. And Tamara is now going to take the mic again and talk about how we plan to do that. Again, we haven't written this permit yet.
Thanks, Dominic. So we're still hashing this out, and there's some outstanding legal issues to get through, but we want to share with you the general direction that we're proposing to take this new permit. So as Dominic just explained, we're proposing to shift towards more fail-safe actions to achieve water quality condition improvements, and with doing that, providing alternative compliance options. And then also, we aim to support the city's positive progress that they're making by shifting from the current prescriptive permit to providing more flexibility to the city for strategizing how it's going to comply in the future. And then also, the current permit includes quite extensive reporting requirements. The city is spending quite a bit of its resources developing these reports that they're submitting to us on an annual basis. So we're proposing to decrease the efforts they have to put towards generating these reports, and instead we'll rely more heavily on these information management systems to assess their compliance. And then lastly, we're proposing to provide a framework to further support the city in pursuing future stormwater program funding, and I'll touch on this a bit later.
Just quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Currently the reporting, is that all pulp and paper, or is it electronic?
So they submit it electronically, but it's via email. There's not an electronic database that they're using. We will be, with this new permit, shifting towards using what's called the SMARTS system, Stormwater Management. Can't quite remember the acronym, but it's being used statewide for other stormwater permits. So the Phase 2 permittees use that system. The construction stormwater permit uses that system. Industrial stormwater permit, and EPA actually has recently put out some new requirements for electronic reporting. And so we will be required as water boards to require the city to use an approved database to submit the reports.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So next I'm going to share some ideas we have for the alternative compliance options. So in trying to formulate some options for the city to help them meet receiving water limits, we're envisioning that the city can choose compliance strategies on a catchment-by-catchment basis. So, for example, the city could choose a different strategy for catchment A and catchment B, shown on this slide. So we're working on developing a volume reduction option. And with this option, the city would capture and retain non-stormwater discharges and then also runoff from the frequent small and medium storm events. So in other words, if you're to capture those events from ever reaching or receiving water, this would address the full suite of pollutants that comes through with those events through one solution. And with this option, we're proposing a longer time frame. For example, maybe 20 years might make sense, because we acknowledge the planning and investment that's required to implement successful projects. And then also we'd like to incentivize this option, so potentially maybe we could lighten permit requirements for areas that are being covered by this volume reduction solution. And lastly, as Dominic explained earlier, with this type of solution, we hope to promote multi-benefit solutions. I'm going to run through these. Dominic hit on a few of these earlier, but those could include habitat enhancement, restoration, conservation, water supply augmentation with stormwater, flood control, sustainable mobility, climate change mitigation and adaptation, and potentially community enhancements, and specifically targeting socioeconomically stressed areas.
Excuse me, what's sustainable mobility? Is that transportation, basically?
Transportation-related, yeah. And so those, going back, we're not expanding it to all. I mean, you could go to, things that improve the there's other improvements we could lay out there, but we've presented options that have an ancillary water quality, we think have an ancillary water quality benefit. So if you reduce number of cars on the road, you need narrower roads, i.e. less impervious area, and so there's a benefit, long-term benefit to stormwater quality there.
Say that again.
So when
the roads part.
The roads part. So I was trying to play out the example of why does, if we promote more bus riding, bike riding, and less single, car trips, why is there a benefit to water quality? And roadways are one of our biggest sources of pollutants in urban areas. So if you reduce the number of vehicles on roadways, one, vehicles are a source of pollutants, and then roadways themselves are transport pollutants. So if we don't have the need for as large of roadways and less vehicles on the road, then the long term, I mean, this is holistically looking out beyond 20 years, but there will be benefits to water quality.
So just in my experience, just looking at transportation planning, and in my small area, we have seen roadways increase with the use of more bicycles and, class one lanes being added. So it hasn't necessarily been a reduction in actual impervious surface, but an increase in impervious surface with larger sidewalks and added bicycle lanes.
Yep, exactly.
So would prefer to reduce that, but I just haven't seen that that type of infrastructure move forward.
Okay, that's good.
And then the other thing to keep in mind is when you do that, in our country, we tend to have pretty large vehicles, and we have very large emergency vehicles. You know, if you get, somebody who trips off a bicycle, you get the tall ladder showing up. In some other countries, you have ambulances, which are much smaller. And in fact, even with the roundabouts, you know, sometimes some of our designs in some locations have been a little bit undersized. Just a little sidebar.
What's the range of pollutants that that we see related and rising and falling depending on the number of automobile trips? I assume it's heavy metals from brake pads. I don't really know what else.
So, yeah, you have oil and grease, and then, yeah, as we mentioned earlier, brake pads are a source of metal. But hopefully with statewide efforts, that actually it's called true source control, but they're working with automobile manufacturers to change that. So that hopefully will be a reduction in the future. And then we gave the example, the city is still working on figuring out if this is an issue in the city, but the example of automobiles for specifically in the city bringing in pollutants potentially from surrounding agriculture fields. So if folks that are working in the fields on a daily basis are all going, you know, taking one bus versus 20 separate cars, then potentially that, I'm just thinking outside the box, but that could be a reduction in pollutants being transferred into the city. Yeah.
Hydrocarbons.
I'm sorry. I would just urge that we ground some of this in research and trends moving forward. I think it's really important too. I think there's a lot of great ideas, but I think we ought to look at, you know, sustainable community grants, for example, that are incentivizing certain types of transport modalities and how community plans are being laid out. There's certainly a lot of funding at the state level that is incentivizing different ways of modality, active transport planning, but how is that being implemented in all of our urban areas? What's the nexus there, and how do we see that being played out over 5, 10, 20 years? I think that's important to just ground it in our planning moving forward.
Good. Thanks for the helpful feedback on that. So next I'm going to review another option that we're looking into. And it's actually a modified version of the current iterative approach that we went through earlier. And just like the old approach, it would emphasize that general suite of management measures. But in many cases, if you do this right, it can actually be effective. However, this go around, we need to make sure we have greater assurance that it's going to work. So we propose to hold the city more accountable by requiring what are called reasonable assurance analyses. And these include typically things such as creating a link between the actions you're taking and reaching those water quality targets. And they include the use of best available data. They communicate uncertainty, include validation milestones that align appropriate goals and outcomes with achievable timelines. So we're still working on this further, but looking at a way to support some of the work the city's already doing. So next I'm going to review a few actual viable future projects that the city has identified to potentially meet that volume reduction option that I explained earlier. So Carr Lake itself presents a green infrastructure opportunity, and this is the farmed area in the center of the city that I showed you earlier. And Highway 101, just to give you a frame of reference, runs right there. It's an approximately a 500-acre area, and it's the confluence of a few major creeks, and this area used to be historically wetlands. And the city is working with Big Sur Land Trust right now to look for opportunities to acquire portions of Carr Lake to restore these natural wetlands. And this type of project would facilitate groundwater recharge and infiltration while treating stormwater that's routed through these wetlands. Here's a picture of a small restoration project underway on one of the edges of Carr Lake.
It is, by the way, a lake during a chunk of the year. A big chunk of that is underwater.
Especially this year, probably.
Oh, out of curiosity, does the Carr Lake ag activities contribute to some of the nitrate loading that we see in the city stormwater? I mean, does monitoring data show any contribution? It seems like such an obvious thing to kind of look at. It's
so right the Carr Lake there. Area does drain into the reclamation ditch. Okay. So the city's now we're focusing more on outfall monitoring versus receiving water monitoring, and we want to really hone in on that. Is the focus here is what's coming off of the city's landscape and not the quality of the receiving water data, because there are other inputs.
So the discharge then from the lake is going elsewhere, not into those catchment basins at all.
So we've got we've identified urban catchments, and they're isolated from the agricultural influence. With regards to the lake, the best effort to characterize that was to take upstream sampling locations in the receiving water and then downstream. And after doing that for several years, again, the trends aren't strong enough to demonstrate what's going on, but it's clear that we're not dropping a lot of the agricultural pollutants out because they're going through town and entering another agricultural area and then coming back to that final downstream sample. So the data are kind of all over the map on that, but at times we've found that there's a slight dilution effect between those upstream samples and the downstream. In spite of there being agriculture in the middle of town, there's still some dilution from the non-agricultural areas running off into the receiving waters.
So, Monica?
Just to add a little bit of historical context. In sometime around 2005, 2008, there was a project to create some restored habitat and ecological functioning in areas between the Carr Lake farmed parcels and the urban, high-density residential, low-income residential areas. So it created both with the design of it was considered ways to help use ecological processes to capture any of the drainage. So I don't know. I don't recall now the specific ways in which that occurred, but there was a lot of community involvement, and it was led by Return to the Natives, I believe.
Right.
And it was very, very, I think, very effective.
They're still involved, and I think it's a continuation of those earlier efforts. You might recall one of your compatriots, Gary Shallcross, was intimately involved in the Carr Lake program.
That's right, yeah.
I'll just show you on the map here with the cursor. Unfortunately, it won't be on the screen, but this is Natividad Creek coming in here, or Gabalon, one of the two. This down here is Alisal Creek coming in here, and this is yet a third drainage. But they've completely been channelized for the purposes of reclaiming this area for agriculture. Then they enter the rec ditch in a kind of a confluence of these three different drainages and exit the city through the rec ditch. The upstream sampling locations then are upstream of the city boundary up here on these three water bodies. And those are the data that we compared to the downstream location down here where at the rec ditch where we have a sampling location just outside the city limit.
Okay, so we also wanted to share another project that the city has identified, and it's through the Pure Water Monterey project, which presents some opportunities for the city. And Pure Water Monterey, just as a reminder, is promoting this one water concept for the Monterey Peninsula Lower Salinas watershed by diversifying its water supply portfolio to address the water quality challenges within this area. And as you can see up here, it shows the source inputs to the Monterey One water plant, and urban stormwater is identified as a potential source. So there's actually a proposed project that's partially grant-funded to route city stormwater to the plant. So this is an example of a project that would be true volume reduction for the city. So the areas that are shown with the red lines that are outlining catchments within the city represent 30% of the city's area. And currently, as we showed you earlier, this area goes to the Salinas pump station and then goes out to the river. And this proposed project would reroute water from that pump station to the Monterey One plant. So the project would reduce discharges to receiving waters, which then thereby reduces pollutant loading to the river, would augment water supplies, and provide climate change adaptation. So before we wrap up, I'm going to briefly discuss an idea we have to support that future stormwater program funding component. So asset management planning has been identified by US EPA and other municipalities as a crucial step towards supporting long-term stormwater program funding. So we're proposing to require asset management planning in this next permit. And it would entail the city continuing to improve its understanding of its stormwater infrastructure condition and performance. So that would include, for example, that pipe that connects the Salinas pump station and the outfall, and continuing to get a better understanding of the condition of that pipe. And then with asset management planning, the city would account for anticipated additional stressors related to climate change and identify cost factors to support more accurate forecasting and budget development. And the city is actually currently taking some initial steps towards this type of effort. For example, they've implemented some accounting system changes to more clearly track stormwater permit implementation costs. And they're also assessing some sustainable funding sources for their stormwater program.
Did the city put together a stormwater resources plan?
Yes.
Okay, so they can avail themselves of funding through state board as well for projects and programs.
Correct. Okay. Yep. So as a recap, the purpose of today's item is to provide you the foundation for the permit reissuance hearing in September. And I'm just going to run through the takeaways that we showed you at the beginning of the presentation. So the city of Salinas' stormwater permit has grown in complexity since the first permit in 1999. The city has made significant progress in implementing its stormwater program. But despite all these efforts, the improvements in urban runoff quality from the city still remains a challenge. And then we plan in this permit reissuance to really emphasize the attainment of numeric water quality standards. And while developing this next permit, we're proposing to provide flexibility, alternative compliance options, and really look at ways to support the city in achieving these numeric standards. We plan to recommend reissuance of this permit at the September meeting. I'm now going to hand it off to Heidi Niggemeier with the city, unless you have some questions before we...
Before you do that, we're going to take a 15-minute break, and let's reconvene at in 15 minutes.
Can I make one comment? I really appreciate the image that you closed off with. That is no small connection, because many people who work very hard to provide clean streams, or who are concerned, residents who are concerned with aquatic habitat and aquatic wildlife and riparian areas and so forth, they see these streams, they're in their backyards, they enjoy them, they love them, but ultimately our watersheds drain to the ocean, and a lot of people don't make that connection. They don't see the marine and intertidal area as being probably the most impacted ultimately, where we have no option to treat. We have no option to go in and restore the aquatic habitat that's in that marine intertidal zone. So I really appreciate you using this picture to close this item, to leave us with an understanding of the extent of the watershed.
Those of you who don't recognize it, it's a kelp forest in Monterey Bay.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not Bermuda grass. So we let's reconvene at 10 to 11. Thank you. If everyone could take a seat. Thank you. Now that we had a chance to catch up on our text messages and check the latest on your Facebook page, et cetera. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't take my picture and put it on Facebook? Oh, he put it on Instagram instead. All right, so the city, you're ready? So I'll let you, Dominic, make the introduction transition.
Thank you, Chairman. We are going to hear now from the City of Salinas. Their representative is Heidi Niggemeier. She's the program coordinator for their stormwater program.
Okay, good morning. All right. Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, fellow board members, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to share with you how the City of Stormwater's City of Salinas' stormwater program has progressed from the last time we were here, which is February of 2016, until present. So as you all know, here we go. It's the City of Salinas is, there are four water bodies that go into the City of Salinas, two water bodies that are exiting, and we also have the pump station that discharges to the Salinas River. And all of the water bodies around the City of Salinas are 303D water bodies. We are heavily surrounded by agriculture on all sides and also have that small area in the middle, as was referenced earlier, the Carr Lake area. We also wanted to let you know that the city is broken up into eight sub-watersheds, and we have also broken this up into small urban catchments, as Dominic had referenced earlier.
I got a quick question for you on that. Is your basin DWR designated all around?
DWR designated.
Yeah, under Sigma?
Yeah.
Sorry,
yes.
For the anachronism.
Yes.
And so is it a high priority, medium, or low priority?
I would say it's a high priority.
Yeah, I think you're in a high priority area. I'm sure you have lots of Sigma GSAs.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Definitely.
Thank you.
You bet. All right. So as you all know, in 2015, the city went through an audit with the EPA and the Central Coast Water Board. And a result of that audit indicated that the Salinas' stormwater program at the time was severely fragmented and decentralized. What was occurring is that not only were different departments required to implement programmatic activities to comply with the permit, but they were also tasked with interpreting their section of the permit, developing these implementation activities, and then complying with those activities. And so what we ended up having is a lot of money that was spent on reports and plans to try and meet some of the compliance requirements. However, some of these reports and plans and methodologies were never implemented because the reports were too high level for the people who are actually responsible for creating the implementation items, that makes sense.
What do you mean by high level?
You had people that were in a department, in different departments, and they were tasked with implementing certain sections of the permit. And they had to interpret it, and they had some folks never had any regulatory experience. And so now they were looking at a regulatory document, and if you've looked at our permit, you can see it's pretty complicated. And so they had to interpret what they thought the compliance requirements were. And oftentimes when it wasn't clear, the first place to go was to contract out to consultants to develop plans and put reports together. And we spent a lot of money doing that, but when the reports came back and the methodologies came back, they were very highly technical reports. And so it was oftentimes beyond the grasp of the people who were trying to develop these programs according to these reports and plans. So what we ended up with is plans and methodologies that sat on a shelf, and we spent a lot of resources in developing and getting those plans and obtaining them. Also, we had data collection at the time. Our information management system was fragmented. We were, all of our data collection was happening in all of these different silos, and the information was being collected on paper. And then oftentimes this paper was brought back to someone's office. They would either manually input the results into a spreadsheet, which was specifically kept on their machine or in their location on a network, or it was put in somebody's file cabinet or on a shelf somewhere. And so we had a real fragmented information management system as well. As we referred to in the earlier presentation about structural BMPs, it is a requirement of our permit to assess and inventory all of our publicly owned and privately owned structural BMPs. And so how we were doing those inspections at the time is through hard copy paper. And as I said again, the data would be brought back, it would be input, and the paper would be scanned and stored somewhere, and this data was not live. And you couldn't easily analyze a collection of data. And we also didn't have a lot of manpower to do these structural BMP inspections, which leads to the next slide of 2017. So in 2017, the city was in year 5 of their permit term. And what we had realized is that we had been assessing our city-owned structural BMPs, but our privately-owned structural BMPs had not been inventoried and assessed. So now we had 1 year to try and accomplish that with over 300 structural BMPs. And our permit does state in there that we could utilize a tool called BMP RAM, and RAM stands for Rapid Assessment Methodology. So it says we can utilize BMP RAM or the equivalent. So I thought at the time, well, if it says to take a look at BMP RAM, why not? So this is how I was introduced to Second Nature and their 2N platform. And so we started using BMP RAM to assess our structural BMPs. And the really nice thing about BMP RAM is that we didn't have the manpower to put into trying to get all of the over 300 structural BMPs inventoried and assessed by paper and people. So we utilized BMP RAM, and we contracted with the Second Nature staff, and they easily trained two of our field interns. And so between 4 people, they went out utilizing this mobile application that you can use on your phone or a field tablet, and they went and assessed these structural BMPs. And what was really nice is that when you're taking the data in the field, it's synced to your computer at your desk via the cloud. And so as a stormwater program manager, I could actually see what was happening and what they were finding in the field. I could also see it on a geospatial basis, whereas before I was just looking at a PDF checklist. So now we assessed over 300 structural BMPs in a 6-month time frame. And the wonderful aspect of this tool is now we can see where our structural, on a geospatial basis, where our structural BMPs are located, what type of structural BMPs they are, and what the condition of those structural BMPs was at the time. And so green is good in integrity and is functioning, and red and orange means maintenance is required. So from this tool, I was able to easily see, okay, where are the structural BMPs that need maintenance so that I can focus more of our resources on addressing the issues of high priority. This was also great because you can use these screenshots to present information, communicate information to upper management or city council members. That's easily understandable. Also in the 2N platform are these urban catchment maps. So here is a copy of a portrayal of the city of Salinas' particulate reduction catchment map. And so basically what I wanted to show you is that On this map, you can see the darker areas. So the darker areas, they indicate the highest level of sediment loading to the receiving waters. So now you can take a look and you can say, okay, where are my high priority areas? Where do I want to allocate my resources? And this is the urban catchment map for stormwater volume runoff reduction. And so if you look at the dark blue areas, those show you areas where we have the highest amount of stormwater runoff. So from this, I am now able to take a look and say, okay, as a stormwater program manager, where am I going to allocate my resources? And I can do this by looking at where my high priority areas are. So this is our information management system now utilizing this platform. And in this platform, we have geospatial project tracking. You can actually, from your desk, you can input your information on all of your regulated LID projects. And you now can link the projects to the parcels that they sit upon and the structural BMPs that are actually on that parcel. And you can determine if, you can take a look at that and you can determine, is that parcel runoff neutral? Because the real gain we're trying to achieve here is we're trying to achieve pollutant load reduction and runoff volume reduction. And so these are some of the tools that the city of Salinas is now utilizing to determine this. You can also track all of your information that have to do with your LID features, like your O&M agreements, your maintenance declarations, your contact information. And this also gives you a way that you can pre-populate letters to send out to private structural BMP owners to let them know that they need to complete their maintenance because it's due and their structural BMPs are out of integrity. The 2M platform, this is just a simplification of to show you what it does. So in 2016, when we started this, we just developed a baseline. And so this here shows the baseline loading of one of the urban catchments within the city of Salinas. And as you can see, it's a dark brown, so it's a high-priority pollutant loading catchment. So once we went in and we added all the structural BMPs and what condition they're in and all the non-structural BMP activities that we're doing, like street sweeping, then that actually transformed this catchment from a high-priority catchment to a medium-low-priority catchment. So in doing this, you can see the benefits of the activities that you implement. The idea is to be a performance-based stormwater program. So over time, you'll see we started out with no BMPs, and our baseline was 550 tons per year of sediment loading, and then you transition across. And this is just a slide to show you the idea of why we're utilizing this platform and why we're going this direction is because we want to be able to demonstrate performance over time. So the goal is to change the darker urban catchments to these lighter colored low priority. This also through the teller tool.
Sorry to interrupt. Can you go back to the prior slide? So you said the goal, the goal is to improve the catchment water quality.
Yes, so the goal here is to decrease the sediment loading to the receiving water from the urban catchment that has the darker colors.
Okay.
And so as you start to address that with structural, like increased street sweeping or implementation of structural BMPs, you will actually contain sediment on site or reduce the amount that's running off. And that will actually reduce over time, which should, in the future sometime, improve receiving water quality.
So the 516.7 ton per year is referring to sediment.
Yes, ma'am. Sediment loading.
Tell me what that looks like. What does that mean in the dark catchment areas are showing?
The higher loading areas.
Higher loading.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the lighter areas have less of a pollutant loading to them.
This may be too much in the weeds, but what is it in that software that's telling you how much sediment is in those catchment base
Well, it has to do with an integration of land use layers and hydrological data, and also utilizing a BMP database that shows what the efficiencies of removal is of the structural BMPs that you have on your parcel.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, thank you for bringing that up. So does this actually tie to what's going on, or this is sort of a prognostication based on a set of assumptions?
This is actually a model of what's transpiring over time via the actions that we take. So when we take actions and we input them up into this model, it shows us how we're making improvement over time.
Okay, so you're tweaking the model to include real-time data.
Yeah, and it was actually created off of real-time data for the city of Salinas.
Okay, and then how often are you entering data? Annually, monthly?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time.
And Mayor Delgado has a question.
Yeah, kind of a follow-up. These progressive reductions in tons per year, they're based on real measurements, or they're based on management practice interpretations?
They're based on efficiency removals from the International BMP database according to what structural BMP might be on a parcel. They're based on your street sweeping frequencies.
Kind of like modeling based on what actions are taking place.
Correct.
So is there any monitoring to tell us whether these are accurate or not?
Well, we'll be going that direction in just a little bit.
Okay. And then my other question for now is, what's the thinking behind the time span? So I see 2020, 24, 26, a four-year and a six-year time span.
It was just to demonstrate the goal of what we're trying to do as a performance-based stormwater program.
Okay. And if 150 tons in 2030 gets you 63% of where you're going, do you want to be at zero? Is that 100%?
We don't have a sediment TMDL which says it's zero, but your goal eventually is, ideally, to get somewhere around there.
Okay, so you're in 2020, this would show that you hope to be 63% of the way to zero.
2030, sorry. Yes.
Is that what that means?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Heidi.
That. So this leads us to the tool called the Teller tool that's also within the 2N platform. And the Teller tool, Teller stands for Total Estimated Load Reduction. So it will actually, on a quantitative basis, demonstrate the progress that you're making over time. So this is just another way to look at the progress you're demonstrating. So, for example, in 2018, when we had all of our information entered for the Natividad Creek subwatershed, we found that we had decreased the sediment loading to the receiving water by 36%. And this is a really great way to be transparent and to actually demonstrate to folks on a very simple way the progress that you're making with your stormwater program. This tool is now TrashRAM. You all are familiar with the trash amendments. And so the city, like all others, we were required to map our priority land use areas and then perform visual assessments. And the city of Salinas has gone beyond just doing the hardscape visual assessments. We're also doing creekside visual assessments and taking all this data to create this model that demonstrates what our current trash loading rates are. And so right now, according to this tool, we are 30% of our way to meeting our trash compliance of zero TMDL at this moment. How we went about, we also had to develop a trash reduction implementation plan. And we took, implemented a process where we created an advisory committee, a technical advisory committee, and it was made up of stakeholders throughout the community, which would be city staff. We also included nonprofits and community organizations. And through this, Caltrans. And through this, we held four workshops, and from the feedback from the four workshops, the city was able to create a trash reduction implementation plan that had buy-in from all the stakeholders.
And that was submitted in January of 2019. Another wonderful thing that you can utilize the trash ram tool for, and that what we're utilizing it for, is now once you have all of your trash loading data into the model, you can actually start to look at different drainages within the city. So if I wanted, first of all, the city is looking at education and outreach and voluntary cleanups before we actually go to implementation of full capture devices because they're so expensive to purchase and to maintain. But if we were looking at implementing full capture devices in locations throughout the city, you can take a look at these different drainage areas and you can say, okay, so here's the example of Markley Swamp, and it has about 700 priority land use acres, and this is the current status, trash loading status. So if we said we'll put a full capture device at the end of that drainage, what would be my bang for the buck? And this would treat 400 priority land use acres. So you can, moving through the different drainages within the city, you can actually determine where, if you're going to invest these kinds of resources, where you're going to get the biggest improvement for what you're spending.
Sorry to take you back just a moment. So when back to the trash aspect of it, so when you're including the stakeholders, and I presume that you're getting out in the creeks, are you seeing people living in the creek corridors, or evidence of, so do you have any anecdotal information about how many dwellings there are or how many people are living in those areas?
I can't tell you an exact amount. We do have several ways of tracking that. We do have a field application that addresses the, we call them marginally housed. And so anytime we go out to do a cleanup activity, we take that kind of information down, like how many people are there, how much trash should we remove. And we have also on a geospatial basis where those camps are located and how many people are at the different camps.
So, what's, you have any quantitative input? I mean, you're saying we look at it, we keep track of it. I mean, and by way of background, I think, you know, vice chair, you know, quite familiar with homelessness in various areas. And, you know, we're looking at that as being an issue, a direct issue pertaining to water quality. Aside of obviously, you know, the social impact. So if you wonder, gee, why they're focusing on homelessness, but it's not solely exclusively, you know, Salinas. We're looking at all the other areas within our Central Coast. So, I mean, do you I know some of the cities do an annual count.
I'm not familiar what those numbers are. It's transitional. We do have the city engineer with the city of Salinas here today, Jim Sandoval.
Maybe ask him to give us.
That would be helpful. I know that many communities, provide statistics through the point in time count, and whether that's through, a Home for Good program or a Housing and Urban Development program at the city or county level, you can probably get some of that information if you're able to correlate some of those sites that you have geocoded and encampments. I think that's obviously good information to be sharing among your city agencies, because there is obviously a water quality and unsheltered population nexus that we'd like to drill down to.
I do know that we just recently had a count. They did hold one of those counts, but I do not know what the results are. I just know where the locations of the camps that we've actually gone out and cleaned up, and through our visual assessments for trash, we actually also document where we see that. And I'm trying to keep an eye on where they're concentrated versus how it affects the drainages of
right, and the pathogens, drainage. Let's say, in particular. I think there's obviously some nexus there.
Yeah, because, you know, there's been, some large cities have had issues of hepatitis and, you know, it's well publicized, not just the water quality impact, but also the health impact. So,
and I just wanted to add, we've conducted field visits as well in Salinas, and one of the more challenging aspects of it from a city's stormwater program management perspective is that it's not always city jurisdictional land.
That's
and so,
true.
Like, there's an example where the railroad goes through there. their city, and it's right at that interface where there's kind of a cat and mouse game going on, and so the city faces a bunch of constraints in how it can actually deal with the problem as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we have that all up and down the Central Coast. We have particularly areas in Santa Barbara and Carpinteria or in Summerland where there's Caltrans jurisdiction, where there's UPRR jurisdiction, where it's so there's, you know, a panoply of different agencies, all with different interest in responding to community complaints. And again, this is not necessarily the domain of the stormwater program necessarily, but I do think it's an aspect that we have to include, and to the extent that we can provide any, you know, levers to bring stakeholders to the table to discuss these issues and come up with some solutions. I think it's really important. You mentioned previously working with some of the stakeholders like Caltrans, and so they certainly have an interest if some of this impacts their property, and they also have resources that they could potentially bring to the table. So I think we want to identify where some of those synergies are and work on collaborative solutions. And I'll just say that in a sort of a bigger picture way.
And I'll put it in even a bigger picture, is that I think this is also where the leadership of a city comes into play. You know, you're one of the gears within the city, and, you know, some of these issues, of course, you cannot do solely the heavy lifting, being in the stormwater program, but it eventually gets back to your elected officials, you know, to this issue. I'll leave it as that. Don't want to get any deeper in the subject. But sometime, you know, I'm sure with the help of Google, you'll be able to give me a number, right? Looking at your colleague there. Yeah. Okay.
Chair, right. Could I ask a couple questions?
Yes, of course.
Heidi, can you go back once or two slides? One more. One that showed the catch screens on the outfalls.
The screens on the
outfalls. That was, you had two large pipes. The clean ones.
I don't believe I had that. I believe that was in dumb.
Maybe I was dreaming.
Yeah, you did actually have two. Yeah.
How many locations like this that could be outfitted the way we see? I think you mentioned it earlier, and that maybe Dominic mentioned. How many of these do you have in the city, these outfall locations?
We're evaluating them now, utilizing this. So right now we're looking at identifying through the model where potential locations can be, and then we need to do the field work to see what can truly be implemented.
Okay. I thought you had a number known of how many outfalls you have.
Oh, we do have a number known of how many outfalls we have.
400?
Yes.
A couple thousand?
Yes.
So a lot of these, right?
Yes.
Okay. My next question is, does it cost $1,000 or less for the actual construction of what we see here per pipe, just the construction, the concrete, the screen, the installation? Do you know how much it costs?
I'm sure infrastructure costs a lot of money to put in, and if you're talking about the full capture device, if we put that in, that could at least be $250,000.
Okay, so
yeah,
that's
just a trash rack. That's not the solution required.
That's not the solution. This is just what's currently there.
Okay.
A location and a picture of what's currently there, and then we would need to take a look at what we could potentially implement there.
Okay.
Through field viability.
All right, so this is just a screen with, looks like one of them on the left has some energy dissipator blocks of concrete or something, but that's what's there now. It's not anything that you are looking to in the future. This is just a picture.
Right now.
That's the old school approach to trash.
Okay.
The new dimensional requirement is 5 millimeters screens.
Okay.
So
are we
that's
see
like
pictures?
A 6-inch.
Do we see pictures later of the future or the present modern version of this?
We haven't incorporated anything here yet.
Okay.
It takes people and it takes money. And so we're working on that. But once we have located viable locations for implementation of full capture devices, then we can put that together in some kind of a grant proposal and try and go for some of this money that you all are talking about.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. So Dominic
touched on this earlier, and one of the benefits of the last 3 years is we did get a completely revised water quality monitoring program. The old monitoring program was between the frequencies and the monitoring locations, the data just didn't jive. You were often comparing apples and oranges. I think I presented on this in February of 2016. So the data that we were collecting, you couldn't get anything to actually compare to each other. And the other thing was the way the data locations were indicated, you couldn't parse out what Salinas's contribution was to the receiving waters because there was such a high ag signal. Something else I wanted to add, those four locations that were shown on the Regional Water Board's presentation, there was very little data collected for those. So 80% could be, you know, three out of four. So there wasn't a lot of data collected because the way the program was set up, the frequencies were off. And sometimes when you would go to look for a sample, it was dry. So we had very little data. So that data is not truly representative of what the city of Salinas' discharges are. So that is why we went and with collaborative efforts with the Regional Water Board staff, we developed this new water quality monitoring program. And what we did is we looked at what are our critical catchments, according to the darker colors. And we said, okay, let's look at these three drainages that have different types of land use. And we set up a passive sampling system at the outfall of these three drainages. And the passive sampling system collects water quality data samples over time through the entire hydrograph of the storm. So not only is this now giving us more representative data of the city of Salinas' discharges, it also confirmed our suspicion of the high agricultural signal from the first water quality monitoring program, which, by the way, that monitoring program was in place for 12 years and cost $250,000 a year. And so through this new program, we were even able to save 30 to 40% over what we spent before. So now we're getting good quality data. And a lot we're actually finding that we have fewer exceedances, and the exceedances that we do have aren't through the roof the way they used to be in the old monitoring program. The goal of this is to see, okay, we have these three drainages. So now we have an opportunity to say, okay, let's focus on these drainages. Let's see what the issues are. Now we can look at potentially developing pilot projects, which is a new innovative way to potentially go into the public-private partnership idea. And so we have ways now that we could implement increased street sweeping, which is non-structural BMP, or we can implement pilot projects that have structural BMPs and see, if any, the result of the improvement of water quality we see at the end of the drainage. And so from the lessons learned of these three drainages, we can say, okay, let's look at the other drainages that are comparable, and we could potentially implement those same program activities throughout the rest of the city. And that's the goal. And now we're down to annual reporting. So as they did indicate, our annual reporting is massively time-consuming. It takes about 3 months to prepare the city's annual report because of all the reporting requirements that go all the way back to year one. They, even though we reported them year one, we still have to report them in year five and six and seven. And so this results, last year's annual report was about 2,800 pages long, and it's a massive collection of PDF documents where I personally think PDF documents are where data goes to die because it's not live. And so you can't really analyze data over time. It's stuck in this PDF document.
So who reads these thousands of pages? How's your eyesight?
And so it does take more than 1,000 staff hours to compile, and it takes at least 10 people to put it together. And because our information management system was so fragmented, we had to go and find all these little documents and see where they were and then finally compile them and then start to upload them into an Excel spreadsheet to try and do our analyses, and it just takes forever.
Working backwards always does. I just wonder, I think that it was mentioned by staff that there are new digital database or data submittal web portals that are coming online or already being used, so the stormwater program will be all of this data that Heidi's referring to. She won't, once it's done, it's going to be a big leap, but that year one data, once you get all of that, do you have to submit all of that into the new database that's going to be available or that EPA is going to require? And then once it's done, you will only be updating. You won't any longer have to submit this, continuously submit the same data over and over again, which just seems to me like a very onerous task. Is that part of the benefit of moving to a digital submittal?
So the system that's already available and being used statewide by with other stormwater permits is would just be for kind of your basic reporting that you submit every year, and we're still trying to get a handle of what is that basic information that EPA is requiring, and it'd be more questions like, did you send out a survey to your residents to accomplish X, Y, and Z? It's more like yes, no questions. But the more global program implementation information that Heidi's describing would be housed likely in a different information management system. The city already has a system in place, and they're looking at expanding the capacity of that system to continue to track more information. And so what we're envisioning is that we could actually have, we already do, we have, you know, special access rights as,
do it. Yeah.
You know, as the regulator to go into that system and look at, oh, they conducted X number of construction site inspections this week, and this number is anticipated for next week. So it would be more real-time assessment versus after the fact a year later. And then likely there would be some expectation that on an annual basis they take a snapshot of this is what happened this previous year and then upload that snapshot potentially into that statewide system so it's accessible to the public.
So my question, Heidi, to you is because knowing your work and your approach to this program, which has really turned the tide for the city's approach in being effective with their resources, with their time and their city funds. Now that you've accomplished this compilation of data that was disparately located throughout city records and offices and computers and et cetera, is that a one-time thing that now that you've accomplished it, it's done, and as was noted that regional board staff have access to this digital set of documents, you won't have to keep doing this, I'm hoping.
You led to what we're going to talk about next, okay. In that what we're looking to develop to expand with the 2N platform is electronic annual reporting. And so now we're talking with the regional staff on what kind of compliance they are interested in seeing and what kind of things they were interested in having us report on. And so what we would do is we would have those elements of the permit. We would set up the back end, which is the reporting end. And as the data is collected in the field throughout the entire year, it's also populating the reporting platform. And through this, I can go in as a program manager and actually see how we're doing. I can do it quarterly. I can do it weekly. I can do it whenever I choose. And so I can go and keep an eye on how the program's doing compliance-wise. And then at the end of the year, once the data is reviewed, then I can then lock in this data, and an email will go to the Central Coast Water Board to let them know that the annual report has been, the data has been locked in, and they can go in through their portal and they can view our compliance. So that the only document I really would be submitting annually would be like a corrective action plan that entails how I'm going to address the things, how the city is going to address the things that were marginal or that were lacking, and any changes in the program that we're interested in making in the following year. So it makes it a lot easier.
And then at what point does the public have access to these annual updates and ability to comment on them?
So Nicole Beck is here with Second Nature, and they're actually working on developing a public access portal.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so maybe we can hear a little bit about the timeline for that.
We're also on a bit of a schedule, so.
Okay,
she's
here.
I'm just saying that we have some other folks who are going to be waiting for us. So if it's a very brief little comment, that's okay.
I'm raising this question for a very good reason. Salinas in the past has had a very challenging public participation component to their program, and we had a lot of people who came 2012 and even prior letting us know that the city did not have an accessible process. They had a few meetings, no feedback, no further updates on the website. This was a huge contentious issue, and so I think this step for the city is so critical to the buy-in that you're talking about, because it is a collaborative effort between public-private entities who are contributing to the problem. So that's my point. That is why I think it's very important, and thank you for being here today.
Glad to be here. My name's Nicole Beck. I'm the CEO of Second Nature. The last time I was here was when we were starting this effort with the Central Coast Regional Board, and it's great to see the application that Salinas has taken. As far as public engagement, that's on the roadmap and one of the pieces, right? We're creating everything now in graphs and maps that are easy to communicate. Where our timeline is the city's timeline. So as we develop out that portal and what that looks like and pushing these results and information to the public, that's easy for us to do. A lot of the process has been a collaborative, relationship between the city and the water board and our group. But we're there and have a lot of opportunity to engage more folks. And I think Heidi touched on the trash approach and the trash implementation, and that was pretty cool. Huge number of stakeholders came to the table, including the folks in the Chinatown and social services, et cetera. And we were showing these, here's the city's trash map. Here are the areas that are high priority. This is what the city needs to do over the next 20 years. How can we all kind of, pool our minds and resources and address those? So,
That sounds very effective. Thank you.
Last slide to show you where the city of Salinas is now and what our stormwater program is like now. So now we have geospatial integration of our data. We now more efficiently collect that data through field applications and use of the 2N portal. We have automatic data to information because the field information comes and it's synced with the desktop. We have a transparent way of showing our program effectiveness, and we now have an improved relationship with our regulatory authorities.
This is like a breath of fresh air, Heidi. I don't know how much of what we've seen is a result of your coming into the employment with the city, but I assume you have a lot to do with it.
We have a great team, and we just needed to centralize the program and provide guidance to the team that we have.
Yeah. No, it's very heartening to see. For the first time, I have, what's the word I want to use? Not confidence, but I have a lot of hope that at least the framework and the groundwork has been laid, so that as you start to dial down on BMPs and trying to make improvements to water quality, that at least you've got a mechanism that's going to help you zero in and keep track of that and to see what works and what doesn't work. So, good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, I will second that because I actually have flashback of meeting when Mr. Young was chair, and it was, I should say, the conversations were very tense. And this is day and night, so certainly a tremendous amount of progress, you know, made. And as Dr. Hunter, you know, refreshed my memory about the, at the time, the lack of community outreach, you know, it kind of comes back to my memory. And, yeah, tremendous amount of progress. And it is also, I think, very positive to see the close collaboration between our staff and your staff, because that was part of, you know, the challenges is that there was not a whole lot of mutual, you know, communication, collaborations, and I see you know, right now with a presentation from our staff, everybody being very at ease, you know, and so thank you. This didn't happen by osmosis. A lot of effort took place. So could you introduce the rest of your colleagues?
Yes, so my supervisor, Brian Frus, is here.
Who? And he's raise right your there. Hand.
And he can actually discuss more of the Pure Water Monterey project if you're interested. And Jim Sandoval's here, and he's our city engineer, also our assistant public works director. And Shinobu Okano is my stormwater intern.
All right. I have a question. Sure, please do.
I have a question for Mr. Sandoval, if he wouldn't mind coming up to the podium. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you share with us the challenges that the city has with infill, or what do we call it when we're the redevelopment within the city boundaries with parcels that we're trying to encourage low-impact development aspects to be incorporated into whatever the city is going to permit?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have successes and challenges in that area, and you know, we've got you know, if I back up a little bit, just in road infrastructure alone, we have a $300 million liability of deferred maintenance, and that's not even covering some of the other deferred maintenance we have with sewers and ADA issues and everything else, but. We have a pretty hefty capital projects list the next 3 years, and also development is really expanding and really hot in the city right now. And so, you know, our requirements for LID are pretty robust for developers and for our own projects. We also have a part of our efforts to improve safety with vehicles and moving traffic and also to help congestion. There's kind of these two things we're trying to address. Half the community wants more safe roads and the other half wants less congestion. So part of the time, or sometimes we have projects such as, say, a new traffic signal where if we one example where we want to add a left turn pocket into this, you know, adding a new traffic signal in this this intersection, and just adding a center kind of little island curb to kind of help define the pocket. You know, technically it changes line and grade, and so in a situation like that where a small traffic signal project, okay, now we need LID because we changed line and grade owing to one curb, which is meant to keep people from taking left turns out of the driveways nearby. So it's those little things like that that create challenges. I mean, certainly on the bigger projects, we we integrate LID, and it's a priority, and it's a requirement, and we understand that. We're advocating in this new permit for, I guess, more flexibility in terms of banking some of our LID, you know, when it doesn't make, when we don't get a lot of bang for our buck, maybe for a small road project, you know, banking any kind of stormwater treatment that would have otherwise been done there, you know, to bank it to another project where we could actually get more bang for our buck in it. And I think we have some of that flexibility now within sub-watersheds, but it would be nice to have that expand across sub-watersheds.
Does the city have any projects where it's doing any repaving of streets or sidewalks where it's starting to incorporate rain gardens and low-lying areas where water can percolate into soils?
Yes. Well, one big one, Baranda Road, we're designing five roundabouts. It's a congestion relief project that's going to ultimately support the future growth area that was referred to earlier. And even without future growth, it's congestion relief is actually needed on Baranda. So that we're designing into that, you know, full stormwater capture and treatment as part of that project. And so certainly where there's room to integrate this, we are doing that. And where it's not feasible, you know, we're looking at other areas where we can integrate it and, you know, kind of make up for what's not feasible in a tighter constrained area.
There's an example I want to share with you that happened in the city of Santa Barbara 8 years ago, maybe longer than that. A gentleman wanted to put in, he wanted to replace his driveway with pervious concrete. And you had to be thicker, had to be structurally sound, and he just ran into a roadblock with the city engineers because they said, you know, we can't permit something like this. It's not part of what's allowed to be permitted. You want to put in a driveway here, it's got to meet, you know, our standard specifications of, you know, it's the impervious concrete with the rebar in it. And I'm wondering if you have dealt with any challenges like that with people trying to do innovative things with their properties and your own requirements are kind of butting heads with that.
We've absolutely embraced innovation around this area. You know, we're in the process of updating our standards to be more progressive with stormwater and, you know, in other areas of design. But the city engineer and myself has the authority to approve alternative designs. And so I have one great example. We have a new low-income housing complex that was just built right near Chinatown, which is a low-income part of town that's very needy. They built three large apartment complexes with several parking lots in it, and it's all pervious concrete parking lot. And
how's that working?
It seems to be working pretty well. They're actually just finishing up, and we just gave them their certificate of occupancy last week, literally. But they have a temporary certificate of occupancy, and people are moved in. It seems to be working well thus far this winter.
Do we have a kind of a collection of these examples throughout our region? I know that, I don't know if it's Atascadero or some of the location that was doing changes to surface streets where they had flooding.
Paso
Robles, thank you. You know, all these examples, you know, we should be, I think, collecting and showcasing because it's very worthwhile.
Well, these are required now. So the urgency of providing more demonstrations and more examples is not as great because people, they're required to do it and they'll find a way. But yeah, we we've got a pretty good visibility. The staff has good visibility on where these projects are occurring, but there's just a whole lot of projects at this point, and we're starting to lose that because it's now just happening.
Yeah. Is this available on your website? The city's website is an example of implementation of an LID project.
Good question. Do you know? Do we have? Yeah, the housing project may be on our website. We have some storyboards of key projects in the city. Well, certainly the roundabouts are, yeah. In terms of the development projects happening, that's managed by our community development department. I'd have to kind of see if...
It's just a positive thing to get out there so absolutely. It comes up on a Google search, you know, examples for other, you know, communities to see.
Yeah.
It's a good story.
Good idea.
All right. So I know that Mr. Johnson had a quick little comment, and you know, just like to wrap up this item since we have some folks waiting for us.
Yep. No, I just want to say that my very first meeting on the Water Board in 2011 was in the Salinas City Hall, and it may have been one of the low points of our relationship. I remember Gary Peterson had just been promoted from running the airport to being in charge of public works 3 weeks earlier, and I think the city manager was out sick that day. He was just a deer in the headlights, and we were really struggling to figure out how to make sense of a relationship, how to get the city and the staff, our staff, really pulling in the same direction. And it's just really gratifying and I think a credit to our staff and to your staff that that we've gotten where we are now.
That was a 13-hour meeting.
That was a 13-hour yeah. meeting. Gary Peterson, yeah. incidentally, is now the head of the Salinas Valley Sigma Agency.
Yeah, this is meeting when our new board member, Mr. Johnson, said, "What did I get myself into?" and then it's also refreshing to see when you introduced your colleagues that you didn't have your city attorney present, which
as your spokesperson.
I recall was the situation a little bit awkward that we had.
Well, and those were the prior meetings that we had with Salinas where things were actually contentious and adversarial. I mean, unbelievably so.
But, you know, and to be clear, we're not bringing this up as a way of, you know, playing back the past, but it's more on a, take it as the positive and how much change you have created here and promoted. So, again, this is a fantastic way of concluding this item. So we want to thank you very much. I would like to give you opportunity for staff or our executive officer to have parting comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman. And I also want to thank the city for spending time this morning to really give you a nice picture of what their program looks like today. So we wanted to just thank you for your time today in helping us as we keep plugging along on preparing this permit that we plan to bring to you in 6 months from now. And I just wanted to kind of capture a few of the main high-level things I jotted down about some good guidance we got from you. Specifically, a lot of good tips on how we can continue to incorporate things in the permit to really target the socioeconomically stressed portions of the community and improve the engagement with that portion of the community. Looking for opportunities to make sure that the information the city's providing to us is transparent and available to the public as well, easily accessible, and make the public aware that it's there. And then to really expand upon this concept of multi-benefit solutions and get an understanding of what are the ancillary benefits associated with those. So good feedback on that. And I thought there was a comment said earlier just about really focusing on prioritizing efforts for those high pollutant loading catchments, and I think that really summed up what we're trying to do with this permit, so I appreciated that comment. But there were other things as well, but I just wanted to provide a high-level summary of some of the main things we got out of today. So thank you, and we'll see you in September.
All right, so thank you.
I have a brief question. Doesn't have to be answered today, but when we come back in September, whenever it is, can you let us know how many full-time staff they had prior to 2012 permit to work on stormwater, and how many they have in 2019?
All right. So, Mr. Robertson?
Yeah, I wanted to acknowledge both the city folks who showed up today to showcase the contrast between where we were and where we are. Then I also want to acknowledge Dominic, Tamara, and the rest of the stormwater program. I have the virtue of being able to see the other peer into stormwater programs in other regions, and we have an amazing staff here. They are the Cadillac of the state, and they influence the state program in positive ways. And I just want to acknowledge Dominic and his leadership on that, and the staff and the program.
All right. You know, nowadays we refer to the electric car, but that's all right. Our next item, we're going to have a break, and then we have a field trip at the Community Water Center on 406 Main Street, Suite 421. This is a continuation of our meeting, so, you know, we are not adjourning the meeting officially at this time. So I just want to make that announcement.
So I was going to say it's a working lunch meeting too. So we'll break from here, maybe take your stuff out to your cars, leave it there. Then we'll walk over to our field trip, and then when we break up there, we'll walk back, and that'll be the end of the meeting. Yeah.
So before then, you know, and moving to the other location. While we have everybody here in the room, again, I wanted to thank all of our staff for working late last night until 9 o'clock. Also, special thanks to my colleagues for hanging there until 9 at night. And then lastly, I want to thank everyone for your flexibility in rescheduling our next meeting, because I think that was very important. And you know, it shows a little bit of our agility to be nimble and reorganize things. And they mentioned, okay, John, go do your magic, make it happen. And he did.
Just a point of clarification on the agenda. I did not notice, but I am now seeing, that we have no executive officer report for this hearing.
That is correct. I predicted that we were going to be pretty packed with this 3 days, and I didn't want to slow it down there. This is the first time in 3-plus years that I've done that, but I just wanted to maximize the time available to 4.0 discussion.
Okay.
Thank you.
I agree, although I will say there have been times when we've had really packed hearings that we really just having the EO report there for us to read provides us with some we won't lose track of the other priorities that we have through your report. So I think, you know, in the past we've done a pretty brief discussion at the end of a long, you know, series of days. But right. I agree, John, but I would like to know that that's not one way of saving time or making us more efficient.
And I want to assure you, this isn't habit forming. And I also want to acknowledge the EO report's a great way to get a window into stuff, even if we don't have a physical report out.
Exactly.
You know, it's snippets of where projects are at.
We often ask you to incorporate updates on things that come up in the hearing, and that's how we get a response from staff through your reports in a more timely way rather than waiting for those items to come up in the course of several years of, you know, permit renewals and so forth. So things of high interest to the board typically come up through your reports. So just a comment that I hadn't noticed it was not there.
So you'll get a double dose at the next meeting. All right, so...
Be careful what I ask for, okay.
And that's right. and that'll be a test. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.